Chris, we're known for big release Blu-ray reviews, but lately I think we've become doubly obsessed with TV.
Okay, that's ridiculous. We just rate the good.
Well, we rate the bad.
We rate them both, and there we have the facts of noise.
The facts of noise?
They're all about blue.
Okay, this intro doesn't seem to be living up to my dreams.
Beer?
Beer. Mushy Mushy Digifiles, and welcome to another episode of the internationally known Digital Noise right here on oneofus.net. Well, no, maybe we're not internationally known, but we are about to rock these microphones. This is the Blu-ray DVD review podcast that will never be shut down by the government. Yes, our livers will shut us down long before the government even knows that we are a thing.
Well, the government is shut down, so I don't think they're shutting down other things.
They are not in a position to shut anything down at the moment.
No.
Except
themselves.
Except themselves, which they're doing a grand job of.
They are.
So, applause all around.
I wish I could get paid and do nothing.
Yeah. It's the life of a senator. You know, there was reports apparently yesterday that these reporters were like, you know, we smell liquor on a lot of these senators' breaths. And I'm like, I thought all the Kennedys were dead.
Yeah, no, there was a story where, like, when the official announcement was come that the shutdown was happening, like, something like 50% of the senators were shot, were photographed in local bars.
Yep, sounds about right. I mean,
yeah, that's where I would have been.
It's the Congress of the 60s. It's the Senate of the 60s. So congratulations there, Washington. I am your host, Brian Salisbury. Yes, that Brian Salisbury. And I am joined by my co-host and cohort, Christopher Lawrence Cox.
Human skin loosely covering a facade that you don't need to know anything about.
That's frightening. Chris Cox, no relation. So we're recording this a bit late, and I apologize, but we're still trying to get back on a regular schedule after Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, that was my fault. Sorry, I'm still kind of recovering. More so than I thought. You think, oh, it's good, I've been resting for 2 days. Then you try and, like, act like a normal human being who always acts 15 years younger than he is.
Yeah.
And no, you're not ready for that.
So. Well, it's funny. We cross-train all year for Fantastic Fest by consuming copious amounts of alcohol.
And yet still.
Yet somehow it still creeps up on us.
Yeah, you can only take so many days in a row of that kind of physical and mental abuse before something's got to give.
Yeah, we are a fantastic mess right now. Well, a few housekeeping items to mention before we move on. Just to remind you, you can become a oneofus.net subscriber by clicking on the link on our sidebar. What this means basically is that either you can make a one-time donation to the site, or you can decide, hey, I'll give a couple $5, you know, every month just to ensure that these guys can continue to do the things that they do, the voodoo that we do, that hopefully you love so well.
With blue.
With blue. And so that is still going strong there on the sidebar of the site. I also want to mention that it is now October, which is, of course,
our favorite month of the year.
Our favorite month of the year for so many reasons, not the least of which being horror movies abound. And in that spirit, Watch a Movie with Us is about to tackle a number of your favorite horror films.
I can hardly wait.
I can hardly wait to watch a movie with you.
Yes, it will be fun. We will be somewhat drunk. We will not shut down. We will forge ahead in difficult times.
Yes.
And satire mercilessly the classic movie monsters and killers for your entertainment pleasure for the small one-time fee of $1.99 a pop.
$1.99? That seems ridiculously low, Chris. I feel like we're just giving this shit away.
I don't know how we can even afford to do this. It's like we're losing money.
Well, we're breaking even. I also want to mention that voting has just opened for the Podcast Awards.
Yes.
And as we are a brand new site, I'm kind of excited. This is the first year that anything I've done I felt like has been in consideration or possible consideration for a podcast award. But that all really depends on you guys.
It does, because you've got to get in there to that site. What is it, podcastawards.com, I think?
I believe that's correct, and we'll post the link in this post. But you can vote once a day.
Once a day? That's crazy. That's like voting for the president.
Exactly. It's like voting for Taft, and you can vote every single day.
Taft! Oh! Who's the only president too fat to fit in the bathtub? Taft! Shut your mouth. I'm just talking about Taft.
I can dig that. But Digital Noise, you know, you could possibly put it down for the best movie podcast, best entertainment podcast. Hey, our sports show, Sure Shit Inside the Locker, you could vote for, you know, best sports podcast.
You know, honestly, almost across the board. And don't forget, in the Food and Drink podcast, to vote for our friends at The Beerist.
Yeah.
And for best video game podcast, don't forget to vote for our friends at Rage Select.
That's a no-brainer. Both of those are no-brainers.
Absolutely. But oneofus.net. All across the board for everything we even mildly qualify for.
Exactly.
In fact, we just talk politics, so best political podcast.
Sure, why the fuck not? We would really appreciate your vote. We would appreciate your votes every day, in fact. Maybe get a little bit more exposure for this weird little experiment that is one of us.
Vote now, vote often.
Indeed. Well, self-promotion is officially at a shameless level, so let's get back to why we do this in the first place. You guys, let's hear from you by means of cracking open...
The Letterbox. You've got mail.
The Letterbox. Thank you so much, Torgo. Really appreciate that. Our first question comes from Tyler Mathiasen, who asks, this is a great question, I thought.
He's got a great name, for the record.
Tyler Mathiasen. Ruler of the Upper Peninsula.
Bond villain.
Michigan. If you could be in a buddy cop movie, who would be your partner and who would be the police chief? These characters can be real or fictional.
Well, you know, I feel like Nick Nolte on most mornings anyway, so probably Eddie Murphy, like the young Eddie Murphy. I get up, I'm like, oh, jeez, I wake up.
And you know, you are the guy that always recommends that, you know, whenever before we start a show that we should do a shot, which is what Nick Nolte suggests before they go to restaurants, graduations, church.
Sure.
So, yeah, no, I totally think
that's... Before you get to bed, first thing you wake up in the morning, you know, it's just...
While you're on the treadmill.
It's a little shot in the arm, just keep going. Or in the mouth, as the case may be.
Shot in the face, for sure. So, he would be your partner.
Oh, yeah, young Eddie Murphy, definitely.
Okay, so who would be your cantankerous police chief?
Oh.
Or if you're even going with the cantankerous model, you don't even have to do that.
Just the police chief. You know, I always felt like I'd like to be yelled at by Aidan Quinn. I don't know why. It just seems like it would be a thing to stand there and be yelled at and then totally diffuse his rant by saying something funny that humiliates him.
Sure.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, right on. Yeah. Well, for my police chief, I would really hope that it would be Elliot Gould. I am so in love with The Long Goodbye, and, you know, I like the idea of, as he's gotten older, he's actually joined the force. He's no longer a private detective, but joined the force in order to get back at a lot of the guys that hassled him while he was a private detective. And now he is a completely... He is the police chief with zero fucks to give. And I just think that would be marvelous. Now, as to my partner...
I gotta know.
The answer to that is...
Garfield.
Obviously, Fred the Hammer Williamson.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Fred the Hammer Williamson? Fuck yeah. Right. I mean, I guess I'm going with the 48 Hours model as well.
Just because he's black? Oh, no, man, you are such a racist.
He is the black.
No, that is not true. James Brown is the black.
Oh, man, this is a subject for a podcast we should never air.
I feel that as a white person, I am fully qualified to make this decision of who the black is, and it's James Brown.
I really don't think you are, but I will let you hold on to that delusion. Thank you, Mathiasen, for such a great question. Our second question comes from Daniel Walter, who asks, what is the least relevant special feature you've seen on a release?
Well, most of them, let's be honest.
There are a lot of superfluous extras on some of the Blu-rays that we've viewed. I think my answer is always going to be the idiotic companies that decide that Blu-ray credits, like the people that do the menus and the editing, are their own special feature.
Yeah.
Like, it'll say credits, and you're like, what's this?
Sometimes it's the Easter egg, too, and you're like, seriously?
Oh, fucking New Line Blu-rays that did that used to piss me right the hell. I'm like, this is not a special feature. If you want to include this, then when it starts up, when the Blu-ray first starts up, just put it in there. That's fine. Don't call it a special feature and then fool us into clicking on it.
Yeah. I personally hate it when, you know, I don't mind seeing the original trailers, but when it's like I have a whole separate thing for the 18 or so TV spots.
Yeah.
Seriously, who gives a fuck
about that? when they're different by like a hair.
Not even that different. You know, you're just like, okay, there's nothing. I just watched the movie. What the fuck? There's no art to a TV spot. You know, a trailer, there can be an art to.
But the third TV spot has a quote from a critic at cinemamoviefilm.com.
Yeah, well, whatever. Fuck that site. Do they exist?
Yeah, they do. I don't know if they still exist. They were the only... I will always remember this.
Cinemamoviefilm.com,
they
really?
They were the only site that gave anything positive to say about The Spirit. So when The Spirit trailer was on TV, it was like, they used that quote like over and over again, and I was like, it says cinemamoviefilm.com. That's either a sock puppet that the studio has set up,
yeah,
or the most irrelevant site on the internet.
Was there anyone who actually had something good to say about the Spirit who wasn't, like, I mean, I haven't actually seen it, because I was doing something, I was out of town or something, so I couldn't see it when it came out, and then everyone was like, don't see it, don't see it, so I just never did.
No, you made the right call. That movie is apocalyptically bad.
Wow.
It to the point that you just watch it and go, what were they thinking? What was anyone thinking? Frank Miller directed it. I think I know what he was thinking. yes, that was the letterbox. Thank you for submitting your questions.
I hate it sometimes when you get the commentary track that are people who are like, who gives a fuck what they had to say?
Yeah.
You know, like, why is this person involved in this commentary? You're like, okay, you should get the director, the actors, maybe the writer. I don't give a fuck about the producers, quite frankly, being involved in this conversation. I don't give a fuck about, like, the second assistant script editor. I mean, I've seen ones that are like, okay, you know what? I'd rather see Ernest at this point be on this commentary than you.
Look, the guy who ran craft services on the thing had a lot to say about Carpenter's vision.
A lot of funny stories from on the set.
That's true.
Actually, when they filmed a movie at a warehouse I was living at in Austin called Flesh and Bone with Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan decades ago, literally, I got to be good friends with the craft services guy because that was where the food was.
Yeah.
And
funny enough.
Yeah. I was like, come on, man. Hook me up. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it, man. They eat like 20% of this food every day. You can take whatever you want.
I got your Rice Krispie treat. I got your fresh banana.
They had good shit, man. They had carving fresh turkey and stuff. It was good.
Right on.
Man, that Hollywood Productions don't fuck around, especially with waste. They threw away so much shit.
Can I tell you a really quick on-set craft services story? I won't mention any names or any movies, but let's just say I was on set for a movie not too long ago, and a child actor I observed going over to the dessert table. Now, this was a big production, so it, too, had a really great craft service department, and there was an entire table full of desserts, like all kinds of cakes and pies.
As there should be.
It was incredible. I observed this child actor. I guess I was the only one watching him at this point, or so he thought. He thought no one was. He goes up and starts poking his finger into every single cake and pie. And I was just like, and like all the other press, I'm at the table, I'm like, guys, look at this. What the fuck is he doing? What the fuck is he doing?
Craft services guy wasn't doing his job.
Neither were the parents that were on set to watch this particular child act. I was just like, what the fuck is he doing? That's the weirdest thing I've ever fucking seen. So, I have a lot of respect for craft service, even if this particular child actor does not.
Was it a movie or a TV show with the guy who was I think it was Extras with Ricky Gervais, where he was like at a big movie thing and there was all this amazing food and none of the actors or LA people were eating any of it. And he's like, and he's so hungry. And finally Charles Durning, I think it was, shows up and he's like, fuck that, man. We're character actors. We can eat as much as we fucking want.
Charles Durning would know. That's the title of...
Or something like that.
That's the title of a book I'm writing. Charles Durning would know.
Charles Durning would know.
Well, now it is
in
time.
In the morning.
Now it's time for the reviews. And I do want to remind you that we will post links to every single release that we talk about. And you can get to Amazon via those links and buy that item. And the site will profit from that. Or, guess what? If you get to Amazon and buy anything at all, as long as you got there via our links, we get a cut of that sale.
Say you need a dildo.
You need a dildo.
Say you need a couch.
You need a couch.
Say you need a car stereo.
You need a car. Why are you having me say these things?
Say you need to buy a small white infant.
Say you, say me, whatever it may be.
They don't have to be white. Although I think Amazon only carries the white ones. We should probably send them some messages about that.
Yeah, it's really racist of them to only sell white babies.
That's what I was thinking.
But yeah, anything you buy, as long as you get their VR link, supports the site. We really do appreciate that. But enough of that. It's time that we jump right in here with Iron Man Trois.
Polynesian. Go.
Mulehi. I don't know. I'll just make shit up from here on out. So,
whatever. Iron Man 3, of course, is the third chapter in the Iron Man saga from Marvel Films.
I really thought you were going to say, is the third Iron Man film.
It's the third chapter.
It comes after
saga.
Iron Man 2.
In case that was confusing for you. This is also, of course, more importantly, the first film and the only one we've gotten so far in Marvel's Phase 2, post-Avengers.
Yes.
And I will say that one of the only things that brought me down about Iron Man 3 was that they really felt like they had to keep reminding you that this took took place after the Avengers.
Yeah.
Kind of to the detriment of it. There's this whole side story where Tony's kind of got PTSD about having, like, his episode towards the end of the Avengers where he saved the whole world. Spoiler. In case you didn't know, the world did not end at the end of the Avengers.
What? I thought it did. That's a spoiler.
But other than that, this film, which John Favreau directed the previous two, Shane Black, one of my favorite action comedy directors in the world, took over for him and co-wrote it along with
Well, he's really Drew more Pierce. Well known as a writer because, I mean, this is only his second film.
Yeah, but film his other film with Robert Downey Jr., Kiss Kiss Bang Bang,
is incredible.
Is astonishing.
Absolutely.
So amazing. So this was much anticipated by
Indeed.
Me. And I felt in more ways than not, Iron Man 3 actually really paid off, especially after a mediocre Iron Man 2, which has certainly some fun stuff in it, but it's all over the place structurally. It doesn't really have a big delivery on the end as much as it tries. Iron Man 3 makes up for almost all the mistakes Iron Man 2 did. And the stuff that people most regularly rail against Iron Man 3 for are some of the stuff I like most about it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm very much with you on this. I heard a lot of the complaints, and a lot of them are valid, but some of them I thought were just based on the mentality that Marvel has set up in its other films. I felt like this was a nice change of pace. And part of the reason that I'm willing to forgive some of the, I wouldn't even call them issues, but the pacing decision making was that I only, my number one concern with these films is the character of Tony Stark.
Sure.
And I feel like this, more so than the previous two, is a delving deeper into the mindset of Tony Stark. Yeah. So I loved every minute that he, you know, even those moments he wasn't Iron Man were still fascinating.
Well, that's just it. You know, just like in the first film where the last line of the film is, I am Iron Man. This film means it more than the first film did because so much of this movie, the whole middle act is about what does Tony Stark do when he doesn't have his armor?
Right.
Is he just a guy without armor? Like, is he just a guy like a snobby, self-abusive, like rich guy?
Mm-hmm.
No, he's a fucking mega genius and he can figure shit out and he's engaged and capable and can fight and all sorts of stuff. And they really get, you really get so much more of who Tony Stark is, which is, and it never ruins that by having him get too soft at any given point. Yes, he has to bend in order to become a more whole person in this one, but he never breaks in terms of writing, even to the point where there's a kid in the movie that he has to interact with and it never feels cloying or wrong in there. In fact, Tony treats him like kind of a dick all the way.
Yeah, he treats him the way he treats all of the adults
everybody
in his
else.
Life, which
yeah.
is to say he's a total dick to this kid. And it's hilarious.
It's hilarious. Really, really funny. And it all comes full circle in the end where you go, you know what? Tony is a good guy. He just wouldn't want to admit it to you in person.
Sure. No.
I had a lot of fun with this. And I think much more so than either one or two, it gives you the big final action payoff that those first two movies didn't really achieve. The final fight scene, which is most of the third act in here, is pretty fucking spectacular.
I agree.
Just like suits of armor coming out of his ass all over the place. You know, I'm surprised he could at this point keep a suit of armor in his ass. He has developed the technology that far.
Yeah.
His little bonus extra little mini Iron Man. Hey, Tony, what do you need?
That's a disturbing image. I think a lot of this has to do with the certain variety of hubris that somebody like Tony Stark would have to stare down the barrel of. And yet, even through all of that, he's still Tony. Like, there's never a moment where he backs off of who he is.
No.
And I appreciated that. And I agree about the final fight scene, although there's more complaints that I heard out of that than anything else about, you know, why didn't it come sooner? Why did he make the decision he made after that? And I'm just like, because he's fucking, well, one, there's a reason that it didn't come sooner. I'm not going to spoil anything, but it's there. Just watch the movie. But as far as his decision after the fact, I totally chalked it up as that's Tony Stark. That is the beautiful arrogance and showmanship of Tony Stark. Plus, it feeds in so directly to Shane Black's obsession with Christmas.
He wastes money like the Republicans are doing in Washington right now by closing down the government.
Oh, topical. Yes. File that one away as a joke no one will understand, you know, a year from now. Like, oh, wait, no, they will always spend too much
who's
money.
Who's going to be listening to this a year from now?
I don't know. I don't know why they listen now.
Yeah, well, thank you.
But thanks, yeah.
I will say, though, that I do agree in some point with, I do consider it a flat-out plot hole that the impetus for the final big fight scene and how it, you know, Tony is able to defend himself could have prevented this in, like, a large portion of the events of this movie from happening if he had just activated that impetus the first time he needed to early in the film.
See, that's where I disagree.
In rewatching it, I was like, yep, I was right. They did not do anything to counter that. Now, the question was, later, would he have been able to use it? And no, he couldn't have. But right then, yes, he totally could.
I hope people are enjoying this tango of vaguity that we're doing right now.
I'm just saying, I was watching it with intensity because people had told me, no, they say this. And I'm like, watch. It's like, no, they don't. That still is a hole there. He could have done it there. I mean, admittedly, you got to think fast. But as we've seen, Tony Stark is pretty good at thinking fast.
It's true.
But it wasn't so big of a hole as to distress me from liking the whole rest of the film, because I really thought this is a ton of fun. One of the better of the Marvel films so far. In fact, I'll go so far as to say. And of course, you're not lacking in bonus features, as you'd expect. There's all kinds of stuff on here. This is, of course, the second screen experience, which you've got to get an app and put on your iOS device to, if you want to have those things that where your laptop or your phone or tablet or whatever interacts with the film. The audio commentary with Shane Black and co-writer Drew Pierce, a behind-the-scenes featurette called Iron Man 3 Unmasked, deconstructions of scenes, a deleted and extended scene sequence that goes on for about 16 minutes, which you really have to watch. There's funnier stuff in this than there is in the gag reel, which was actually kind of incompetently put together. You'd think the Robert Downey Jr. dad gag reel would be better, but it's really kind of, it's so mixed up with just behind the scenes footage of stuff. You're like, this isn't even really a gag reel.
Yeah.
Whereas the deleted and extended scenes, you're seeing all those sort of line-o-rama shit where they're like going, mm-hmm. Here's 15 different takes of the sequence that they were improvising the dialogue for. That's actually very, very funny, as well as a giant subplot about a bully for the kid who Tony Stark befriended and are sort of the way that played into the plot that was excised completely. There's a new exclusive glimpse at Thor: The Dark World, but the biggest reason to get this, of course, is the 15-minute Marvel one-shot film Agent Carter that pulls Haley Atwell, who played Peggy Carter, Steve Rogers, Captain America's wartime girlfriend from the first Captain America movie, and it takes place about a year after, where Haley Atwell's now just working in an office. And like, they're like, oh yeah, you're Captain America's ex-girlfriend's the only reason they're even letting you work here at the S.H.I.E.L.D. office. And she's like, wow, what a big bag of dicks. Most notably Bradley Whitford, who's so great on The West Wing, playing her misogynist
boss. And in Cabin in the Woods, of course.
Yes. And then, of course, she gets a chance to prove herself and makes them all look like morons. Really good, and make sure you stay toward after the credits for that one, because there's a really funny post-credit sequence in that.
Hey, Agent Carter, tell me where you been. You know what I really liked about Iron Man 3, speaking of endings, was the ending credit sequence, which, with its color palette and the way it framed shots, looked like the back of any Johnny Gossamer novel from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
I felt like what they were trying to do was like the opening credit sequence from like an 80s television series like Riptide or The A-Team or something. It had that total, the music, the way it was cut up, it would slit the screen up. It was like, this is an opening sequence from an 80s show. Oh my god, that's awesome.
Dun, 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 dun. The A stands for Avengers in The A-Team. That's what people don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that was Iron Man 3. Now we're going to talk about the East.
Did you get to see the East?
I didn't. I missed this at South by SW.
This is the story of Eastman. He came from the East
to battle the amazing Rondo.
No, sadly, it's not the story of Eastman. This is actually the newest film with Britt Marling, who's become sort of this, like, not just the indie darling among the indie crowd. Her appeal's really spread out much bigger, where people are super taking notice of what she's doing as an artist, not just as an actress, but as a writer. Now, this one she's working with, oh god, I gotta say this guy's name, Zal Batmanglij.
What?
Well, at least part of his name is Batman.
Oh my god, it totally is.
He's the guy who directed her in the film, 2011 film, Sound of My Voice. She always tends to write her films with her director, whoever it is. And this movie is certainly the most commercial thing she's done so far, but which is to say, it's still very much a very character-based, like, smart indie film, but it moves really fast and has action and tension and stuff, much more than you'd expect from her previous films.
Yeah.
Alexander Skarsgård stars in here with her, along with Ellen Page, where she plays a former FBI agent who now works as an operative for a private intelligence firm headed by Patricia Clarkson. Not actually Patricia Clarkson, but the woman she plays.
Ah, okay. Because
that would be
weird.
Weird.
Yeah.
It's like, all movies now are just going, this is the end wise. They're just like, well, we're just going to have actors play themselves. People love that shit. You know, she tells her boyfriend she's going to Dubai for a mission, but the truth is she's actually going not that far away, where she is going in search of the East, which is an underground eco-terrorist activist group that has really been like taking down pretty big corporations with their acts of not like explosive terrorism, but still dangerous terrorism. She ends up getting hooked up with them, with the help of Shiloh Fernandez, who you know from The Evil Dead.
Oh, right on. Yeah, yeah.
The lead male role in that film. And gets brought to the compound of the East, where she's accepted rather quickly as a member from this group, more or less led by Alexander Skarsgård. As the film goes along, it becomes clear that these guys have a really good point about some of the stuff they're doing here with how fucked up these corporations are, including the very corporation she herself is now working for. And she has to contend with her lifetime of training of being an agent and being loyal to the job and slowly coming to terms with what she actually believes is right. Now, this isn't one of those boring beat you over the head with its message films on the whole. It actually presents you in a very interesting moral quandary of saying, what would you do in this circumstance? Because certainly these guys are not this eco-terrorism group. They are terrorists, and they're not as good. I mean, they're hurting people with their actions. They're just hurting bad people.
Yeah.
But you still go in a real world sense. I mean, they're not Batman. The writer's Batman, but this group isn't. What would you do? And it provokes a lot of questions. It's a very interesting film. It's very well acted. I enjoyed the hell out of this movie. I mean, I really loved it. Apparently I believe it was Sundance where this aired. It was one of the few times that they said like almost no one ever left the theater after the movie was over. It's like 98% of the audience stayed for the Q&A,
really?
Which, as you know, for these fests, usually about half the audience take off for a Q&A starts. Everybody wanted to see what they were going to say about this because they were all like, okay, I have some things I'd like to point out.
There were
out.
So many people still in the theater that someone called 911.
I really enjoy this. It's probably not for everyone. There's some people I know who are infuriated because it asked them to think about real life stuff. Aww. Movies that address real political issues. How dare you make me think about things?
I don't want to be thinking about no real world stuff.
I don't want to be exposed to opinions that vary from my uninformed own.
Burp, 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 flower, flower.
That shit drives me up the wall. It really does. It's like, even if you don't agree, you shouldn't be irritated that they're offering a varied opinion. That being said, the Blu-ray comes with 4 deleted scenes, a slightly different theatrical ending, a series of featurettes in the behind the scenes, and that's about it.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm definitely going to have to check this out. It sounds awesome. Hey, speaking of South by Southwest, why don't we go ahead and lead right into Scenic Route with Josh Duhamel?
Oh, that did play at South by, didn't
it?
That was one of the midnight movies that I did not get to see.
But you've seen it since.
Oh, I've seen it since. Yeah.
I was like, because I haven't, so it was on the list. So
leave you hanging out to dry here. Like, come on, Brian.
I'd have been like, yes, Josh Duhamel is...
Talk about it, Brian.
He's one of the warriors of the wasteland looking for the last drops of gasoline.
I'm going to be like Jigsaw and force you to review this movie, even though you haven't seen it.
I want you to review this movie you haven't seen.
Yeah, like I said, this just came out recently in theaters, what limited of a release, mainly festival release it got. And that's probably because the only 2 stars in this are Josh I never know how you Duhamel. Say it. Duhamel? Is that... Mm-hmm. That's just weird. Josh Duhamel and Dan Fogler, neither one of which one would look at and say, A-list actors, let's put them into a movie that's pretty much a two-man play.
Josh Duhamel is always the guy you call when you can't get Timothy Olyphant.
Except you probably shouldn't, and you just shouldn't make that movie.
You should just stop right there.
The thing is, like, most stuff he's pretty horrible, and here he knows he's being put to the test. I mean, this is an acting movie, and he's... not bad. Nothing in this makes you go, wow, we should give that guy some more challenging roles. Funny enough, Dan Fogler, who also is one of those guys you go, why would you give him a serious role in anything, is actually pretty damn good in this movie.
Really?
Surprisingly, he's actually very entertaining and convincing in this. But the plot is...
I do find that surprising.
The 2 guys play Mitchell and Carter, who are 2 old friends who are driving across the country and have taken a titular scenic route when the car dies.
Ah, damn it.
In the middle of the desert.
Wouldn't you know.
Off the beaten path.
Eaten by cannibals. Where,
no, wait, no cannibals.
No? Okay. No,
although they do shave Josh Duhamel's head into a mohawk, so.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cannibal guy in the desert looking.
It's cannibalistic.
Cannibal-ish-tic.
Well, what's happening?
But they end up starting fighting about stuff because Josh Duhamel's character has basically, he's got a serious, like, he's got a wife now, and he's kind of, you know, that thing that guys do when they get in a significant other relationship and they suddenly go, I can't hang out with all the other douchebags any longer because, like, my wife doesn't really like you, and I got better, more important things to do. I got to grow up now. He's that guy now. And Dan Fogler doesn't like it because he's decidedly not that guy. He's the guy who got left behind as he's decided he is going to be a great writer no matter what. He just has a hard time actually writing anything anybody wants to read. And this conversation this conversation they're having builds and builds to being more and more angry and upset at each other until basically they essentially put both their lives in mortal danger by just their obliviousness to their actual situation, the fact they're in the desert, and ain't nobody driving that route.
Ain't nobody gonna drive that route.
And of course, the cell phones don't work.
Well, yeah, because it's a movie.
The thing is, this is a tolerably entertaining drama that like has, like I said, a good performance from Fogler, an okay performance from Duhamel, and just, you know, it doesn't do anything you don't expect it to, except for the twist ending, which is slap your forehead, predictable and stupid at the same time. Like, really? Really? Is this what you wanted? Okay, if you say so. And I would argue that it's a dearth of imagination here that makes this film not a really interesting piece it could have been.
It's idiodictable.
It kind of is. I mean, it's not like it's the dialogue is badly written or anything where you're rolling your eyes. It's just, it never goes to any place truly interesting with these characters, and they kind of fall off the wagon of civility a little too easily, quite frankly.
They were just looking for an excuse. The radio knob came off. I'll fucking kill you!
I love how in Hollywood that's always the case. Like, the moment, hey, I think the soda machine's out of Diet Dr. Pepper. Fires, stars, flames. It's like the fucking Lost Tribes.
It's like that SNL sketch where they have that morning talk show and their teleprompter goes out and then like they cut back two scenes later and it's like, we have to build a shelter. It's like turning the chairs over. I am the new god.
Pretty much. So yeah, I can't really recommend this, but if you're a fan of those actors, you might enjoy seeing them do something a little bit different, certainly. But this is, it feels like an early film by somebody. I don't know. Maybe it's not. The guy Kyle Killen, who wrote this, apparently worked on the shows Lone Star, Awake, and Mind Games. But, you know, as a first movie, I guess, it doesn't have that much to recommend it.
So, movie I am disappointed I missed at South By, and one I'm not so disappointed I missed at South By. And moving on, I am so fucking excited to talk about this next release, because it's October, and that means we're talking about Halloween, the 35th anniversary edition.
The only song I know how to play on a musical instrument.
This only has three notes and I'll keep playing.
I was a kid. I was like, I can play a song. And my parents were fine. Like, oh, you need to cut that shit out right now. Seriously, that needs to stop.
We don't even need to tell you what Halloween's about. And if we do, fix the fact that you haven't seen that film fucking immediately. Are you kidding me?
If you're a horror fan, mind you.
No. I don't care if you're a fucking Disney-phile. See Halloween, damn it.
I would argue that while Halloween is a great and important film in the canon of horror and especially, more specifically, slasher films, it has been so copied to the point where it's like an abuse victim at this point itself. And you can't watch this freshly now without being reminded of 1,000 other things that have happened in 1,000 other movies. It will seem like this movie is cliched to some extent by that.
I could not disagree more. It's been copied. Yes, there are entire franchises that owe their existence to this film. But then again, Halloween owes its entire existence to Twitch of the Death Nerve, Black Christmas, most of Giallo films. I mean, this is the film. It didn't invent the slasher movie. It invented the American slasher movie.
Well, yeah, and it probably did it better. Well, definitely did it better than anybody had at this point. I mean, like, a significantly better than anybody had before this,
and
in my mind.
It's so well made, and it's so well constructed, even while satisfying all of your genre urges. that it's like comfort food to me. Like but it's not comfort food in the sense that I watch a lot of bad movies and enjoy them in that same level. This movie is a fucking work of art. Absolutely, from start to finish. And this version, now you're thinking to yourself, well, why did they put out yet another Blu-ray release of Halloween? There's actually a really interesting reason why they did this. And that is so that they could go in and take out what... Because, okay, so Dean Cundey is the director of photography who shot most of John Carpenter's films.
Let me point out right now, he knew that off the top of his head without looking at the screen.
Dean Cundey shot most of them. Larry Franco produced most of them. I mean, I could go on and on. But the thing about Dean Cundey is he sat down with them on this release and went through it and did a complete remaster because in the original version that he shot, it wasn't full of warm autumnal colors. It wasn't so orange and brown as it is that when we watch this movie, there's a particular color palette that we recognize as being indelible to not only Halloween the season, but Halloween the film.
Sure.
That was not at all the way it was shot. That's something that was changed in editing.
Really?
Yeah. So Dean Cundey is basically going through and going, okay, no, this is how it looked when we shot it. Now, there are good and bad points to that. I think if anything is a negative, like I love that they did this, first of all. But if there's anything that's a negative about it, it does, without those sort of, those warm hues of orange and brown, it does make it painfully apparent that this was not shot in the Midwest as it professes to be. Those colors that were sort of exaggerated and oversaturated in the final version that we all know and love kind of mask the fact that it was shot in California in the summer and not Illinois in the fall.
Sure.
But that is really my only even remnant of a complaint. This transfer is fucking gorgeous.
So I think we can agree that this is one of the worst movies ever made, right?
No, we cannot agree to that, and I will stab you in the face.
I'm just trying to turn you into the shape right now.
I will Nick Castle your ass all over the place. I do have a soft spot, as this is one of my favorite films. Not one of my favorite horror films, one of my favorite films, period. But I do really love the fact that they've gone, and this is like, it's like watching it in with an entirely new set of eyes. And the color is so rich and deep and the details are so striking that I was so happy to see, like, wow, this is not just another recycled release. This is not a double dip. This is something truly remarkable. And whether or not you get behind the way this one looks versus the other one, there is a very distinct reason for its existence. And the fact that Dean Cundey is the one behind it going, okay, well, here's how it looked when I shot it. That's remarkable.
So there might be a good reason to keep your previous version if you have it on Blu-ray of Halloween, which wasn't a bad transfer at all, but it was just a very, very different look to it.
I read a lot of negative reviews about that other transfer, but frankly, I've never had a problem with the Blu-ray that was put out of Halloween. I thought it looked pretty damn good, but I thought this release and what they did with it was gorgeous, and apart from a few moments where the setting could have really benefited from having those oversaturated colors.
Sure.
It was really interesting to see sort of a cooler blue and a deeper black, and it was, wow. I was really blown away by it.
Yeah, I really enjoy this film too. Like I said, when I was speaking of the cynicism towards it, I think that's mainly directed on people, like I said, are coming to this I never got around to seeing Halloween. I think they'll still say, well, I realize it's a good movie, but it was harder to enjoy.
I guess
if you've seen all those other films.
I mean, that's sad, but I guess I can't really argue with that.
That's probably true for all sorts of stuff.
I saw this movie the first time when I was 6 years old, and it was one of the, 5 or 6, I can't remember exactly, but it was one of those moments where it was like, the parents let me watch it with them, so I didn't even have time to be scared because I was so jazzed about, oh my god, I'm a grown-up now. This is watching the grown-up movie. And it became a Halloween tradition in my household for years to come after that. And, you know, my dad is really the reason that I got into John Carpenter, and then you could go forward to Hitchcock, and boom, where I am right now.
There's the point where this shows the flash of your dad and this text on the bottom of the screen, like Animal House. It's Brian Salisbury's father is serving 35 to life in maximum security prison.
I mean, that's one of those things that, I mean, I was going to be happy just to see, you know, a new Blu-ray of Halloween if it had had something worthwhile. If it was just a double dip, it probably would have angered me more just because of how much I love this film. But not only do you have this entirely new high-def treatment this high-def transfer, but you also have some new special features.
Yeah, a whole new commentary between John Carpenter and Jamie Lee Curtis. They've recorded one for the previous version, but this is a brand new one that goes into very different stuff that they did before. They're older, more experienced. They probably have a different viewpoint now on things than they did before. So it's interesting to go and see this older version of these, this great actress and this great director come together and talk about it in retrospect now.
There's a really bizarre but still kind of enticing special feature on this called The Night She Came Home, which is a documentary about Jamie Lee Curtis going to my hometown, Indianapolis, to a horror convention and trying to raise money for charity by, you know, doing the things that horror stars do at horror conventions, which is sell their picture and their autograph. I mean, I do appreciate she was doing it for charity and not just to pay the rent.
Sure.
But it was just interesting to see the other side of that, because I've always been a big opponent of the idea of paying for autographs and paying for pictures. Like, I am not against these guys making money, don't get me wrong.
No.
But I live in a town where film is so revered, and the experience of cult film is such, you know, is something that people just have so much respect for, that when celebrities come here, they feel that. They get that sense. And I've never had to pay for an autograph. Well, I would take that back. One time I did pay for an autograph from James Hong, but he was trying to raise money to make his new movie. It wasn't just to pay the rent.
It's weird for me with autographs and that sort of thing. It's like, it feels like, and this sounds weird, but like you're objectifying that celebrity even more as just a symbol, not even a real person by that. You're just putting value on this autograph or something.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't really have any interest in that. What does that do for me, having that autograph? What it does is it creates that atmosphere of like, you know, they're this person who's not really a person like I am, for me, anyway. That's how I kind of look at it.
I get that. I totally get that.
I'd much rather just exchange a few words with someone than get their autograph.
I totally get that. It's, you know, and it's one of those things that if I were to show the average person, the average film fan, the autographs they have, they would not give a shit. Because to me, it's not about... and I don't do it often. Like, I don't ask for autographs. Like, of all of the...
Only porn stars.
Yeah.
And they're all on your breasts.
Right. Of all of the filmmakers, the actors, people like that I've met, I think probably only a fifth of them I've gotten autographs from. And it's always because I have like this sort of special affinity for them. Like, I have William Lustig's autographed on a poster.
Hmm.
Most people don't know who William Lustig is. I don't care. It's like, for me, that was a special... Getting Fred Dekker to sign my Night of the Creeps laser disc. That was a special moment for me.
Will, of course, significantly increase the value of that already valuable item.
See it again. These are things I'm not going to sell. Like,
you never know. Things could get tough.
Well, let's hope. Hey, oneofus.net listeners, please don't let things get that tough. I would really fucking appreciate that.
Well, there's also an extra feature here, 25 years later, which visits the neighborhood afterwards, including the restored Michael Myers house. Apparently, it was like a shithole for a while, but now it looks like it did in the movie pretty much.
The Myers house.
Pretty cool. Yeah. And then there's a collection of the scenes that were in the television cut that never made the theatrical cut.
I do have a gripe, and I don't know if this is due to shipping problems or what, but this is a very skinny sort of digibook type design.
It's weird how thin this is.
It's super thin, and there is a booklet inside, which is awesome. And I don't know if the one they sent me to review was just sealed too tightly, or it spent too much time on a truck or what. But the tops of every single page in that booklet were stuck together.
Oh.
And when I tried to take the pages apart, it tore the top of almost every single page.
Sure you weren't, you know, touching yourself while you were...
I wish, because at least then I would have a reason, and it would be sort of a badge of honor. But this was just like, I was like, wow, it's already been completely defamed before I've even, you know, had a chance to really even pop in the Blu-ray.
Because, you know, if you see Jamie Lee Curtis with her shirt off and trading places.
Hey, don't get me wrong. She's got a great set.
She's got,
speaking of objectifying actors.
Come on. They like, in the 3D version, it can put your eyes out. Let me just put it that way.
The 3DD version. but yeah, it was just like, what the, why? Why are, come on. But again, it may have just been a simple issue of maybe it's set on the, cause it is Texas. So maybe the glue just got too hot sitting on the UPS truck. I mean, who knows? If you guys run into that problem, please let us know in the comment section, because we would like to know if this is a problem with the actual release that maybe somebody needs to recall or get you a new version.
True.
Let us know, and we'll see if we can get some notice to the studio.
We'll do what we can.
We'll do what we can. Well, that was Halloween, the 35th anniversary edition, and now let's move on to the King. We're going to go from fall to summer with the Kings of Summer.
Wow, look at that segue. You're the king of segues.
You know what's funny is I hate Segway tours.
Well, have you actually ever gone on one of those?
No.
No, me neither. So stupid. But you, every time you walk by those people, it's like, I was the guy who was picked on a bit in school, but I turn into the bully when I see those people riding down their little helmets, driving, meh, and now over here we can see the South Congress Bridge. You know what? I am so going to punch you in the face just because you're on that fucking stupid.
Get on a bus or just walk it. There is no in between. Yeah, that's why I hate them, is because I am usually the one on the sidewalk. I'm like, oh, God damn it, fine, go on. Yes, yeah, you all look ridiculous.
Your little future of transportation.
Oh, that's adorable.
That's so cute. Kings of Summer is a 2013 coming-of-age comedy drama. It first premiered at Sundance. We got to see it here in Austin this year. At least I did. I don't know if you got to see the screening or...
No, I did not.
I'm really glad I got to see this in the theater. The story here, of course, follows a guy named, kid named Joe Toy, played by Nick Robinson. He's a teenager.
Which is funny because we know a guy named Nick Robinson.
We do, I know.
He's a film producer.
Like, wait, what? This is definitely not that Nick Robinson. You'll know because he never takes his clothes off in the film.
Or you know, he's the guy in the film is not drinking Four Loko and collecting Air Force Ones.
True. But he's having trouble getting along with his single dad, Frank, played by the great Nick Offerman, who's, I'm so glad to see him popping up in more and more little indie films now. That guy is awesome. But kid Joe is like, you know what? This is bullshit. I'm a man already. I need to be free. And so he escapes to a place he's found out in the middle of the woods, an unusual little clearing deep in the woods, bringing along with him his best friend, Patrick, played by Gabriel Basso, and this weird kid, sort of like Antonio that we know, named Biagio, played by Moises Arias. And he announces that they are going to build a house out in the woods where they don't have to have parents telling them what to do. They don't have any responsibility. They're going to farm the land. They're going to live free.
And those teddy bears can finally have a goddamn picnic.
But the truth of the matter is, like, if this was me, and I think I did try and do this once. I'm not sure. I think most kids decided they were going to run away and build their own house out in the woods somewhere at some point. But they actually do it. To their credit, they build a house out in the woods. Now, it's not a house that can withstand the elements for but so long, but it is a workable house. And they decide...
It has four walls and a roof.
It has four walls and a roof. It's got multiple... I mean, it's like the best treehouse ever that they built for themselves out there. Very, very cool. And they're, you know, they're reported missing. They don't give a fuck. They're living out there. They're going to have fun. Unfortunately, a problem comes when the girl that Joe's always had a crush on, Kelly, played by Ellen Moriarty, gets invited out to see the house by him. And, oh, what is this? Love triangle? Uh-oh.
Wouldn't you know it.
Wah, wah. Teenagers, groups of three boys should not have one girl hanging out with them.
It's just mathematically inappropriate.
Trouble will erupt.
Yeah.
Unless you're a Mormon or in reverse or something. I don't know.
What's a Mormon in reverse?
You can have multiple husbands.
Oh.
Old Mormon, I guess.
Old Mormon.
I guess they don't do that anymore. I don't know. I don't even know. So, I like.
I don't know. I saw the documentary Big Love for a few seasons.
Yeah, man, not a documentary.
What?
No. Bill Paxton.
Not a Mormon?
Is actually an actor in Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. Mm. Weird. But this is actually a very sweet, very funny movie that, you know, it's one of those, it's hard to say too much about it past what I've already told you because it starts giving away the little fun, little punchy, funny surprises that come along the way. And a lot of the heartwarming stuff. And ultimately, you, of course, come to a point where this is a, you know, it is a coming of age film and it has a lot of smart stuff to say about that. And it does it well without ever seeming cloying. It's also got Alison Brie in a small role in here as Joe's sister. And she is like super ridiculously hot, as we all know.
Very
so
nice.
That's never a bad thing. Mary Lynn Rajkub. Rajkub.
She got me, man.
comedian from 24, amongst other things. I always say her name wrong, damn it. I actually looked up how to say her name not that long ago, and I've already forgotten. But she's great. She has a small role in here. This is a terrific little indie film that I really, really recommend going out of your way for. You can actually, even though it's a little uncomfortable at points with like some of the sexual overtones, this is still a film you could even watch with your parents or your brothers and sisters. And yeah, good movie. Well worth a look.
Right on. Well, speaking of movies that are worth a look, or maybe a second, third, and fourth look, why don't we talk about Room 237, the documentary on the quote-unquote conspiracies of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Well, you know, the thing about Room 237 is that if when you watch it very closely, you can see that the whole film is actually an allegory for oneofus.net and its secret plan to conquer the world. No, I'm serious.
I'm listening.
You have to look very closely. Okay, now, when you watch the scene at about 15:17 in the film, very in slow motion.
Okay.
You can see right there.
Oh, shit.
You see that point right there where he's got a red scarf?
Holy crap.
That look at the shape it forms. If you were to fold over the screen like the old Mad Magazine back covers.
Which is possible.
Uh-huh. It's the logo for oneofus.net. Right there.
Mind
with the window.
Blown.
And that, I mean, there's
How
no way.
How did Kubrick
way
know?
That, or the people making the film about Kubrick know.
Oh.
There's no way that was accidental.
Wow.
Yeah.
No. That's pretty much the lengths to which these guys go to prove that there are conspiracies within The Shining. Okay, so here is my big problem with this film, is that nobody associated with this film seems to understand what the word conspiracy means, because what they're really talking about is subtext. And it's like, yes, some of the stuff you're referring to, insanely specific as it may be, might have been Kubrick's intention for subtext. He's not trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes like, ha, they'll never figure this out. Why would they do, what possible reason would we have had to do that? Like, I'll give you a great example. Ooh, hello. I'll give you a great example. He talks about the typewriter and the stacked luggage, how the shot from the, like, transitions from the stacked, ownerless luggage goes into the typewriter as an allegory for the Holocaust, where
sure.
you had all these. And I'm like, yeah, he could very well have been talking about that, because the whole film is really about man's innate predilection towards savagery, like, and toward, you know, bloodshed. So I get that that may have been a visual reference to that, but that does not make it a conspiracy.
Well, you know, okay, I'm going to come out in defense of the theorists in this sense, that I don't feel like those guys, the person who was saying, talking about it being something about the Native American genocide and people talking about the Holocaust, they actually have some reasonable points to make along the way here that may or may not just be coincidence. I mean, certainly as you go along, it's clear that if you stare at anything for long enough, any work of art, you're going to begin to see patterns and repeating patterns that if you study chaos theory at all, you'll know that's the nature of chaos. It forms itself into patterns that may mean absolutely nothing.
Ian Malcolm taught me that.
Yeah, yes, he did. And you ended up not getting eaten by dinosaurs. So congratulations.
You
apparently were paying attention. and, you know, I mean, it's conspiratorial the way that they're dealing with this, in the sense that these are not themes that this movie, if these are true, if that Kubrick by some chance really did intend to insert these themes as a subtext into this film, they're not even mildly worn on its sleeve.
No.
These are subtexts you would have to really look for and interpret. And sure enough, Kubrick often had subtext within subtext and layers to his films. It wasn't uncommon for him to have little bits like that thrown in there that were more for his own edification than anything else. I mean, not necessarily even expecting anyone to find these things.
Yeah.
So yes, is it plausible? Kubrick never really talked about his films after he made them.
And he was a weird dude.
He was a weird dude. So it's hard to really know for sure what's true and what's not.
That's fair, yeah.
To the level which I would say it is kind of conspiratorial when you're talking specifically about this degree of subtlety with subtext. And certainly one of the theories in here, which first off, you have to start off by believing that the moon landing was a hoax and that Stanley Kubrick was the one called in by NASA to film the hoax of the
moon landing. That's an actual conspiracy.
That is actually conspiratorial.
Yeah.
And saying that like the movie is filled with references to that sort of like is Kubrick's way of that he wishes he could tell you that he faked the moon landing, but he obviously can't because the men in black would come kill him or some shit. You know, it's funny, if you were to like, okay, suspend your disbelief and go, okay, the moon landing was a hoax and Stanley Kubrick was in some way involved with that, then their argument seems very convincing.
On that level, absolutely. I just, you know, and to me, but again, to me, like, that is the only true conspiracy that's really examined in the film. Everything else is just, I mean, you can choose to believe it's coincidence or intentional, but even if it's intentional, and I think they make a very good point for some of the stuff being intentional, it's not this grand cover-up, like, You know, Stanley Kubrick is not in the background, like, twirling his mustache, like, I'm covering this up, they'll never get this. That's not, like, that's counter to the nature of being an artist and being a filmmaker.
Not necessarily,
like, though. I'm going to hide everything so no one sees it. It's
not
like,
not necessarily,
okay.
Though. Kubrick was a guy who made intensely personal films, and it's clear he did some stuff in his films that he didn't really care whether or not anybody got it or not.
And that's,
he did stuff just for himself. And that might very well be some of the layers that are here waiting to be uncovered or we'll never really know, quite frankly. But, I mean, like I said, it's not a conspiracy, but I would call that when you discuss things that are that hidden, conspiratorial. And I think that's what they're getting at. I don't have a problem with it being discussed in that context. That being said, what this film is really about is the love, obsessive love of movies. And people who do watch movies again and again and again, like you with Halloween. By the way, what's Halloween really about?
Halloween, it's really about it's about suburbia not being a safe place anymore. It's about the American middle class now being completely vulnerable to attack.
Not so subtle of a subtext.
It's not a terribly subtle subtext, but I wouldn't call it a conspiracy by John Carpenter.
Well, no, because it's not subtle at all. That's what you call subtext worn on the sleeve. It's almost just text.
Yeah.
Or whatever the opposite of sub is. It's above the ground.
It's super text.
It's super text. You know, I appreciate it on the level, which this film is really, it does put you in a mindset where you have to examine the way you intake art and the way you study things that you have gotten really obsessive about. The fact that, like, it makes you look at, like I said earlier about that idea, like detecting patterns doesn't necessarily mean anything. Just because there are patterns doesn't mean they add up to something. It could just be, it's more likely to be coincidence than not. Has a lot to say about conspiracies in that way, in that all these people are detecting all these patterns, putting them together and declaring there's a bigger picture to it, subtext or not, which is very similar to the way that people come up with conspiracy theories. In fact, identical to the way people come up with conspiracy theories. So that's even another connection to accurately saying, okay, this is conspiratorial in the way that they're dealing with it. Now, this movie is required to watch one of the special features afterwards. Absolutely have to watch one of the special
features. Is it the forwards and backwards thing?
No, because that is dull as fuck.
Yeah, that's at Fantastic Fest, because there's one of the theories they talk about in the film that if you watch it simultaneously forward and backward, meaning that you take it backward and actually transpose it over the forward version, then all these things line up in these really interesting ways. I would not use the word interesting through that experience, but they did that during Fantastic Fest, where they actually showed it forward.
Yeah, now that's not on here because they probably couldn't get the rights to have The Shining twice on the movie.
That's
but,
true.
No, there's a live from the first annual Stanley Film Festival special. It's about 50 minutes long. It's a panel discussion with the director.
The Stanley Film Festival?
Stanley.
Oh, as in Kubrick. Okay.
Yeah, it's a Stanley Kubrick. It's at the Stanley House, which is the house where, Stephen King wrote The Shining initially.
There are a lot of conspiracies in here, true believers.
But it's with the director of this film, with one of the guy who had the moon landing theory, with the director of the TV miniseries version of it, of The Shining that came out, and with with Kubrick's longtime friend and former assistant, Leon Vitali, who comes in and just assassinates all these theories, just tears them apart. And really, when you finish watching this, you'll be tempted to believe at least one or two of these theories are really plausible. You won't be after you watch this extra feature. And I think it was really cool that they've decided to put this on here.
Yeah, sort of the other side of the coin situation.
Exactly. It's annoying that Devin Faraci is the host of the whole thing, but other than that.
Well, there you have it. Well, moving on from Room 237, why don't we talk about... Oh, God.
What?
All right, let's talk about I Spit on Your Grave 2.
I can't I must have been bored the day I put this in. I think I just didn't want to get off the couch, and it was closest one I could reach, and I was like, well, I know I'm going to hate this. Why am I even going to put
this
in?
There are very few films that I just will not request because I can't.
I didn't ask for this one.
Oh, okay. Well,
they just sent it to me.
Well, I hated the remake of I Spit on Your Grave.
It wasn't so good.
Well, it had taken all of the possible subtext about women and what it means to be a feminist and what it means to live in a male-dominated society and sort of the revenge of the woman, took all of that out and just made it as sleazy as possible. I mean, you want to talk about torture porn? That's what that movie was. That's what the remake is. Like, the remake should be the movie that you go to. Like, stop going to Hostel as the definition of torture porn. Well, start going to the remake of I Spit on Your Grave.
Then you'll love this, because this makes that look like a Disney film.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It's literally an hour into this film before it even starts to think about her you know, getting away and starting to be able to, you know, get the revenge. That's like an hour, about 45 minutes of rape and torture. Now, I'll hand it to the original I Spit on Your Grave. The actual rape scene is a tiny piece of this film. It's over relative.
You're talking about the original.
The original, original.
Not the remake.
The original, original.
Okay.
They get it over with. It's horrifying. And the rest of the movie is her cutting people's balls off and getting wreaking revenge, which at least you're like, okay, well, at least they didn't make me fucking want to throw up for an hour first.
Yeah.
They just got it over with, and now I'm rooting to see these guys get killed.
Well, there's a social contract that goes with rape revenge films, and that social contract is we will sit through this deplorable act of violence because we know that by the end of it, on some level at least, the moral compass will be righted. And my problem with the remake is that there was not a balance at all. It was tipped way in the direction of the rape.
It was just lascivious towards rape and torture. And who the fuck, if you really want to see that, you need to reexamine your priorities.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something's wrong with you.
You know, it felt like it was made for the horror fans that non-horror fans think all horror fans are, if that makes any sense. It feels like it was made by people who have never actually talked to a real horror fan, and they assume that the only horror fans in existence are the weirdest dudes who go to the horror conventions.
And this is the same thing. It's about a girl named Katie, who played here.
Wow, they gave her a name. That's really progressive.
She actually has a name. Played Jesus here by Christ. Gemma Dahlender. I've never heard of her before, but she didn't even have a link on Wikipedia, so I guess she's nobody.
as the movie will treat her.
And she wants to be a model. She's from Missouri. She's a waitress in a New York City restaurant. She calls an ad which advertises free professional photos, which are run by three Bulgarian brothers. What a great sign. She gets in there. They try to get her to take off her clothes. She gets offended. Really? You answered an ad in the paper.
From
get
Bulgarians. There's
three scary looking Bulgarian dudes and you didn't think they were going to ask you to take your clothes off. You're going to ask all high and mighty. Well, you're pretty stupid from the get-go. That's not how you become a professional model, first off. That being said, she realistically says, I'm out of here, and leaves. The problem is that one of the brothers is he's a little mentally disabled, and the youngest one of them, and is obsessive, and he shows up in her apartment, starts to bind, gag, and anally rape her.
Wait, this is the mentally disabled one that's doing this?
Yes.
Jesus Christ, movie.
Yeah.
Jump up your own ass and die.
He calls his brothers, because he ends up having to kill a neighbor who shows up when he hears her screaming. And, like, what do we do? It's like, well, we got to clean up your mess. So they abduct her and somehow take her from New York City to Bulgaria and leave her in a basement where they
continue. Yeah, I think there's a direct flight from Kennedy to Bulgaria.
Let you take a big shaking and muffled screaming box with you. Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. Most of the movie is her tied in a basement on a mattress with shit covering it, getting repeatedly raped, tortured to the point of having, like, a electric cattle prod shoved up her vagina and activated repeatedly. I mean, this is, why would you want to watch this? And eventually, when it finally turns to the point where you're like, okay, now she's going to go around and get her revenge. It's so unsatisfying in any way. It's just gross without any sort of feeling of like, this is real anymore. Cause she's such an awful actress. Like when she's turning around trying to be all like, look at me, I'm a badass. You would laugh if you weren't already so sickened by everything you just watched. This is just terrible. Everyone associated with it should stop making movies. You know, what the fuck is wrong with you?
What a surprise that Stephen Monroe, who directed this, also directed the remake. And you know what, dude? I spit on your films.
Oh yeah, and Mongolian Death Worm, which I actually watched, and it was fucking awful.
Maybe Stephen Monroe, you should stop making film. And we don't say that to a lot of people. But when you're not only untalented, but you're making despicable torture porn masturbation material for sociopaths, maybe there's no room for you. I don't know. I'm just going to throw that out there.
I agree. This is terrible. You should skip it at all costs.
Well, one movie you shouldn't skip, because it's fucking great, is Prince of Darkness, which is one of the latest from Scream Factory, the Shout Factory horror offshoot. I love this movie.
I'm right there with you. This is one of my top three favorite John Carpenter films.
And I'm going to go so far as to say that it may not be his best film, but it is his scariest film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this film is genuinely creepy, and it takes you places that you don't expect. Even at that point in the 80s, when horror was getting to that point, it was just kind of repeating itself. Everybody was doing the same things over and over again. Mm-hmm. It was one of the movies that genuinely found something different to do with horror that was genuinely frightening. In fact, the ending of this movie haunted my dreams for months afterwards.
Well, there's that recurring image throughout the entire movie of this broadcast that comes into their dreams. I mean, the story essentially is about a group of scientists who are called into a church because there has been something discovered in this church, a sort of weird orb of this floating green goop. I mean, nobody really knows what it is, but they know that its energy readings are completely off the charts. And clearly there are people out there who are interested in this and want to get their hands on it. So they're trying to figure out what the hell's going on with it. So there's this image, this transmission, essentially, that is coming to these scientists in their dreams. And it's just the front of the church. It's like someone holding a handheld or a news camera walking along the front gate of the church. And when they get to the door, just in the distance, you can see this like really tall, emaciated, cloaked form standing in a foggy doorway.
Yeah, you're not sure what's going on with it in this
weird
voice,
disembodied voices.
You can kind of make out saying, are you reading us? We are sending you this message from the future. It is the year 19.
And then just, yeah, it's creepy as all
you're
hell.
Like, what does that have to do with what's going on?
Yeah, and I love movies that sort of play with the idea. Like, I mean, you have the movies where it's like, oh, the devil. And then there's like, no, hell is almost like this extra dimension, like this weird sort of Lovecraftian relationship between the earth and hell. And I dig the shit out of movies that do that.
Yeah, it reinvents, like, the whole definition of what the devil is, you know, really even having as one of the main characters here, the priest Donald Pleasance, who's got to be in a John Carpenter film, you know.
I shot him 6 times. The evil has gone from him.
All right. We're not reviewing Halloween now.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. I understand. Who has discovered that this tank filled with the anti-god that was in a secret section of a church run by an extremely secretive Catholic sect.
Mm-hmm.
And is the first to realize and be upset when he realizes most of the Bible is fucking bullshit. They kept the truth from people in order to keep them sheep because the actual truth was too fucking horrifying.
It's like if you could mix the Book of Revelations and the concept of the devil with Ghostbusters, because apparently the devil's just been in an ecto-containment unit for the entirety of human existence, and now there's the very real threat that he's going to get out.
Something strange in the church in the hood. Who are you going to call?
Alice Cooper! Wait a minute. No, don't call
him. Don't call Alice Cooper. That's bad. He's bad. Victor Wong!
Victor Wong! Yeah!
I love Egg Chen.
Oh, man. Donald Pleasance is in this. Victor Wong is in this. You're going to see a couple of different people that ended up working with Carpenter multiple
Dennis
times.
Dunn, who's Dennis been in Dunn. Almost every movie he's done.
Yep. Every movie he's done. Dennis Dunn.
Yeah. This is so much fun. It's so inventive. The gore is really creative and good. I mean, there's so much neat stuff to say about this. I don't even want to spoil particular moments because you'll be like, wow, that was a neat idea. And it was still a very low budget film.
And I like the fact that it kind of comes full circle for Carpenter. I mean, we talked about the fact that Halloween, which is his first big hit, was sort of owed its existence to Giallo. And this film feels like an Italian Nightmare Logic type film, like a Suspiria or a different Argento film.
Except mixed with like Primer or something.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole level to this where all this stuff fits in with science.
Yeah.
Like, this is the ultimate evil, but mathematically we can understand that.
Totally.
And in fact, Carpenter apparently had been reading about theoretical physics and atomic theory, and that's what gave him the idea for this movie. I can't stress enough, if you've never seen this, to sit down, you know, just watch the film. Don't watch it with a bunch of friends talking over it. Just watch the film and have just the time of your life. It really is great. And this being Scream Factory, they of course have loaded this up with lots of fun extras. There's a brand new interview with John Carpenter talking about how religion and faith and ideas of it has informed his films along the way. There's an interview with Alice Cooper, who has a small but important role in the film.
A very kind of terrifying role in this film.
Yeah, very much so. He gets one of the best kills in here.
Yeah.
Interview with the actor and special effects visual effects supervisor Robert Grasmere, a look at the film's score with the co-composer, an alternate opening from the TV version that insinuates by its editing that the whole movie was just a dream. I don't know why anybody would have done that.
I love seeing the extra footage from TV versions where it's like we had to cut a certain amount of the film out for content. So essentially what's been shot is this like entire Halloween, the Halloween Blu-ray we were just talking about does the exact same thing and has the like the TV footage of like the actual hearing where Loomis is trying to argue that, you know, that Michael Myers should never get out of the asylum. And here there's an alternate opening where, yeah, it just insinuates a lot sooner that all of this is some weird dream.
Well, and, yeah, but I wouldn't say the movie itself, that's its intention at all. Mm. You know, that's the thing, is this edited TV version makes it look like everything that happened in the movie was just a dream, which I was like, why would you do that?
Yeah. I mean, it's weird, but it is still kind of fascinating to watch. It's like, yeah, like a chapter of the film's lore.
I mean, especially because, like, the actual film opening credits take over 10 minutes long, or over 10 minutes long, and they cut, this is basically just the opening credits, which have been cut down to about 6.5 minutes here.
I'm so tempted to just end this show and go watch this movie again right now.
I
know.
I just rewatched it. I loved it so much. One of the, there's a, even an Easter egg, Prince of Darkness 25th anniversary screening for 12 minutes with a Q&A with Carpenter. That's really fun. He's really funny in it. And audio with Carpenter. And the best thing on here, I thought, was Horror's Hallowed Ground, which is about a 14-minute look at the film's locations where they were filmed. Is he actually, this guy, Sean Clark, goes around from place to place, and they do a great job flashing back and forth between the scenes in the movie and where he is. And it's kind of neat getting to see the actual church. And now it's like a movie theater, you know, like art theater, but it's pretty cool little feature. The best part is he's got a t-shirt that I want so bad. It's a takeoff on the classic Carpenter's album, you know, the brown album with the yellow text, except it just says Carpenter. And in place of the faces on it of the two Carpenters is the two of the characters from They Live. And I was like, okay, I've got to have that t-shirt right now.
Definitely. Yeah. Sean Clark actually is the one who hosted the documentary on the Halloween Blu-ray of Jamie Lee Curtis at the convention. And this particular Horror's Hallowed Ground is a feature that's appeared on other Scream Factory releases. It was on The Howling, too. Okay. So I think it's one of those things that they are going to use that as often as they are releasing a movie that has an installment.
It's a neat feature. It's because of him, he makes it much more interesting than the topic sounds.
Sure. Well, moving on from Prince of Darkness, which it pains me to do because I could talk about that movie all day.
The Prince of Darkness show!
We're going to talk about The Haunting of Helena.
Do we have to?
Well, you put it on the list, so my answer is yes.
All right. Well, this is from the Bloody Disgusting collection. Of course, Bloody Disgusting.
And that was The Haunting of Helena.
Is a website, the horror website that, you know, I mean, I don't have any problem with what they do there, really. It's just they're kind of, their reviews are very short and compact. They tend to get, it seems like they get reviewers who are fans of horror to the point where they don't have the ability to parse critically a film.
I've always sort of found them to be, and this is probably not going to be a very popular opinion amongst its readers or the people I know that write for that site, and I'm sorry, but I've always kind of found them to be the ain't it cool of horror.
Yeah, I'm kind of right there with you. I mean, it's a well put together site in terms of the way it looks and the structure of it, but I find a lot of the writing on it to be just, like, guys, you can't love everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
What is that? And this is actually, I don't know who gave them a deal to start putting out their own horror movies, or just producing their own horror, I guess. Whatever they say, we like this movie, put the stamp of Bloody Disgusting on it is more likely what happened. They put out some good stuff that way. This one is actually passably good for people who maybe have never seen Ghosts Who Kill movies, which there's way too many of now.
Yeah.
The Ghosts Who Kill genre is getting a little too expansive for my taste. I like ghost movies, but the Ghosts Who Kill is like, all right, ghosts aren't supposed to kill. That's a little weird.
As long as we don't get a resurgence of the Ghosts Who Rapes movies, because the entity is fine, but I don't need to see that come back as a genre.
I would like, the actual entity movie is a pretty good movie.
It is a good movie. Barbara Hershey's great in it.
This story features a woman named Sophia, who's moved to the south of Italy with her daughter, Helena, the titular Helena, who's just a little girl. And they're trying to get away from, you know, everything in the old life, because she's separated from her husband, who's kind of a douchebag. He left her for a hot young thing, and now he's in the islands somewhere and hasn't even seen his own daughter in 4 years. I mean, he's like disinterested completely. Problem is, when they get to this building, this old building they live in, they find this beautiful closet. I don't know why they're able to take it up to their apartment. Apparently it's in the storage area of this place. So they're like, hey, let's take this big wardrobe. And they take it and they bring in their thing in their apartment. The problem is that it hides a dark secret.
Wouldn't you know?
And that dark secret is the ghost of a woman who, during World War II, basically her husband apparently abused her, beat her, tied her to a chair, ripped out all her teeth one by one while she was conscious, and locked her in the closet to die. So this ghost is a little pissed off.
I would say so, yeah.
And is a pretty fucking creepy looking ghost. Whenever she comes out and she's got no teeth at all, just these big gaps everywhere, I was like, okay, that's actually really fucking freaky looking.
Right.
And kudos to the guys who did the effects on her, because she looks great. The effects in general on this are pretty good. The problem with this film is that this storyline that should just be the first act of the film goes all the way through this film until the last 10 minutes or so, when they suddenly introduce what should be the beginning of the third act twist, where you get a wrap up. But the beginning of the third act twist just ends up being the Twilight Zone-y, you know, do 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 do. You know, we're like, oh, come on, man. You spent the whole movie on the same thing. You've got to move the plot along at some point. And they tease you the whole way along that they're about to, because there's all that, like, I've got to go to the library now and type on the computers and look up on microfiche what the stories of what happened in this old house during World War II. Yeah,
movies are the only place I've ever seen anyone still use microfiche. That's like, apparently that's still a thing, but only in movies.
Microfiche.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
Thanks for all the fish. Something smells fishy. I don't know. There's cool stuff in this movie, but it drags it on way too long, and ultimately the ending just comes across as stupid, whereas it could have been cool if it was the beginning of the final arc. But it just felt lazy, like, well, we never could figure out how to end this, so let's just make the mid-movie twist into the final twist. Ultimately, if you've seen, we've seen too many of the Killer Ghost movies with the character who has to look up and research the history to know what the ghost wants to really be surprised by anything that happens in this.
For the Craig T. Nelson moment where it's like, oh my God, they moved the headstones, but they didn't move the bodies.
Oh, you just gave me the chills.
Well, moving on from there, we're going to talk about a pair of films that are also Scream Factory releases.
Yeah, we got a lot of horror this week.
Yes, well, it's funny how October hits and all of a sudden it's horror.
Best month of the year!
I love it so much! But we're going to talk about Psychos 2 and 3, which are both being released by Scream Factory.
That's right. That's two Psychos for your money.
Hell yeah.
How do you like them apples?
I'm going to go psycho for this deal. Are you kidding me? Stabby, stabby.
Well, here's the thing that a lot of you guys out there may not know, and this may come as a bit of a surprise to you, you know, because, of course, Alfred Hitchcock films, sacred, right? You don't do things to Hitchcock films. You don't remake them. You don't do sequels to them. Why would you, right? That's wrong. Any sequel to a Hitchcock film can't be good. These are actually pretty entertaining.
Yeah, well, it helps. Okay, so I'm going to start with Psycho 2 here. Psycho 2 is one of my favorite horror sequels. I love this movie. I think this movie's great, and it has no reason to exist whatsoever. It was made 23 years after the original, and as you'd said, it's not something you saw very often in the times. Let's do sequels or remakes of Hitchcock. Like, at that point, and I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that at that point, the only person who'd remade a Hitchcock film, or maybe not
well,
the only person.
Everybody has done their own version of Rear Window.
Own version of, yes.
But not one called Rear Window.
The person who most remade Hitchcock at the time was Hitchcock.
Yeah, and Brian De Palma.
Because, you know, he remade Man Who Knew Too Much and so on and so forth. But anyway, Psycho 2 was directed by a guy named Richard Franklin, who's an Australian director who is, you know, he'd been hailed as Australia's Hitchcock. No, he was Australia's De Palma. He was the guy who spent his entire career trying to make Hitchcock films. He directed Patrick. And Patrick, of course, is the Australian cult film about the coma patient who is killing people with telekinesis. But the story of what happened to Patrick's mother is Psycho. And he also directed a film called Road Games with Jamie Lee Curtis and Stacey Keach, which is Rear Window on wheels. The guy's entire career was this affection for Hitchcock. And the fact that he was given the keys to do the sequel to Psycho is so fitting. And he does a great job with it.
And it's a nice little, it's not just, let's just remake Psycho and call it a sequel. I mean, it's years later. Norman Bates has gotten out of the insane asylum where he rightfully should have been, because he was no question not aware of what he was doing when
he
was killing
such a great
people.
Explanation too of where he's been for 23 years. Yeah. It's like, did you see the end of Psycho? He's in the fucking asylum.
And
that's where he is.
And is Norman Bates, as a person who Norman Bates is very peaceable. He just wants to be kind of left alone. He wants to live his life. He's a quiet introvert. He's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. The problem is he's got that other part of his, that schizophrenic part of his brain that believes he becomes his mother and kills people. Spoiler.
Yeah. spoiler. I'm spoiling Psycho.
If you haven't seen Psycho, and it really, come on, at this point, why are you even listening to the show if you haven't seen Psycho yet? Or at least know what happened during it. So years later, people in the town strangely are a little more welcoming than you might think. This is like not the same town in the television show Bates Motel. No. This is a town where it's a small town, and they go, look, he served his time. He's come back. He's from this town. You know what? We are going to believe that he's healed and he just, you know, everybody deserves a second chance.
And I like that this town, which, you know, as we get into Psycho 3, we'll talk about a little bit more, it retains the sense of alienation. Like, it's cut off from the rest of civilization. Like, there's a couple little buildings that we go to outside of the Bates Motel, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
It really does make you feel like this town where the Bates Motel is in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Oh, yeah. And it is.
And it is.
The problem is, despite the fact that a lot of the people in the town are being very welcoming to Norman coming back, and he seems very healed and happy to be back, Lila Loomis, the sister of Marion Crane, who's played by Janet Leigh, of course, in the original film, has decided that no matter what, Norman Bates is crazy, he's a killer, he's going to kill a lot again, and she's determined to do, like, whatever it takes to yell at whoever will listen, you have to listen to me, he's gonna kill again. And interestingly, they actually got Vera Miles, who played her in the original film, to come back and play this role.
Yep.
Nobody wants to hear it at all. And
it is kind of strange how the entire town's like, shut up, bitch. What's he ever done to you? Oh, he killed you. I'm sorry. Well, sorry. That's true. Granted, he did that, but come on. He's a good guy.
20 years. Let's come get on. Over it. Let bygones be bygones. You know, I would have probably moved away from the town.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know what? Whatever.
Come on. That's all cars under the swamp. Let's move on from
like, that's y'all's problem now. But Norman seems to be holding up because now he kind of has a girlfriend played by Meg Tilly, who plays Mary Samuels, a hot young thing. Boy, Meg Tilly was hot when she was young.
Oh, she was beautiful.
Damn, she was back then. And what was it? She was in The Big Chill too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so hot. She works with him at the local diner where he's gotten a job and is like defensive of him. And it's like, hey, I don't have any place else to stay because of an abusive boyfriend. Norman's like, why don't you stay with me? Of course, as we watch this come together, people start dying. And the question is Norman doing this? Someone else doing this? What's actually happening?
He starts to wrestle with images and hallucinations and the thought that maybe he's regressing to those ways that, you know, in that lifestyle that he thought he was done with. So it's a very interesting sort of mental battle for Norman throughout the entire film.
Yes. Now, Psycho 3 picks up 1 month after Psycho 2.
Yeah.
Bates is running the Bates Motel, and, you know, yeah, we can't say too much because you want to watch Psycho 2 first.
Yeah.
There's a huge plot twist at the end of Psycho 2 that affects everything that's happened in the Psycho films, and I cannot reveal it to you. But suffice it to say, everything is kind of back to where it started with Norman.
Yeah.
Again, you know, in Psycho. And, so that's going to be problems when he's running the hotel openly and more people are coming in and he's having hallucinations and stuff. Everything gets shook up though and goes a different way he doesn't expect when a nun who had tried to commit suicide after losing faith in God, played by Diana Scarwid, shows up and basically begs for shelter. And Norman is so incredibly taken with her. She's taken with him that despite his, you know, insanity starting to come up again, she's starting to give him hope that maybe he can be normal and have a normal life. Complicating it is Jeff Fahey.
Motherfucking Jeff Fahey.
Who's Dwayne Duke, a rocking man of the road, who takes a job with Norman to help run the hotel during the daytime hours. Problem is, he's kind of rapey.
He's a little rapey. And further complicating things is the new sort of, I wouldn't say court-appointed, but Norman is saddled with this guy who's the manager of the new manager of the hotel played by Dennis Franz, who is just such a dickbag.
Yeah, he is like encyclopedia under sleazeball. It has a picture of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he's got all these issues of these people that are just fucking with him. And again, even though, you know, we've talked about this sort of bridge from Psycho 2 to Psycho 3 that kind of sets things back in motion to where they were for Norman originally, he's still trying to be a good guy.
He doesn't want to be a killer.
No.
Desperately. And he's aware that it's like he's an addict who has, yeah, in Psycho 2 has quit his addiction, but it's always there. He's constantly afraid he's going to pick it up and get addicted again. And I'm not talking about killing. I'm talking about believing his mother is around, which leads to killing. Psycho 3 is about that point where you're like, you know what? I'm fine. I can handle myself. I've got my addiction under control. I'm a functional motherholic. I got it. It's fine. And is just trying to keep himself from killing people.
Yeah, and this film was actually directed by Perkins himself. This franchise has had a lot of it's interesting mix of directors. You know, from Hitchcock to Richard Franklin to Perkins himself to Mick Garris in the fourth one. I mean, it's just...
Never saw the fourth one.
The fourth one is sort of a made-for-TV quality, so it's not great, but it is cool in the sense that it's Norman calling in to a talk radio host and explaining everything that happened in his childhood. Then we see flashbacks where his mom is played by, I always get these two confused. Is it Annette O'Toole or is it the woman who was Juliet in the Italian Romeo and Juliet?
I don't know.
Anyway. But yeah, so I mean, so he's calling in and talking about all this, and then he's talking about what he's going to do to the hotel and the house once they're done talking. And it's just like, what? And, yeah. And it's fun. Like, it's really dopey, but if you watch all these movies, all the sequels, maybe don't watch the original first, but if you watch all the sequels back to back, it's a really fun evening to go from Psycho 2 to Psycho 3 to Psycho 4. And
did you know there was another Psycho movie that was made for TV that has never been aired after its initial airing at the request of the director?
No.
Yeah, I was reading this on Wikipedia. There's an entirely other
Olivia
Psycho
Hussey.
Film.
Sorry, that's the
yeah, the in like a whole Psycho movie. Never been seen but once, and he fights to this day. He keeps on top of the legal battle to make sure nobody can see it.
Well, we're finding that movie. I mean, obviously, we're going to find that movie.
I want to see it.
It's got to be at I Love Video here in Austin.
Somebody had to have bootlegged it, right? Now, the thing about bonus features, it's a little odd, because I would say Psycho 2 is a little better than Psycho 3.
It is.
But Psycho 2 has less in the way of good special features. It has an old EPK. It's got audio cast and crew interviews and an audio commentary with Tom Holland. Psycho 3 actually has a bit more stuff. An interview with Jeff Fahey, who's awesome. I love Jeff Fahey.
Yeah,
he was so
great.
Good on Lost, too. I wanted him to be a bigger, like, have more of a payoff in Lost than he did.
I loved him and Michael Biehn in Planet Terror as brothers. That just made so much sense to me.
You have an interview with Kat Shee, who talks about the casting process and what working with Anthony Perkins was like. Interview with the special makeups effect creator, Michael Westmore. A weird person to choose for an interview, Brink Stevens, who is a scream queen and famous body double, who is the body double for the actress who played the nun here, who does all the nude scenes.
That is really weird.
And for some reason, they're like, yeah, let's interview her. Fuck it. And I was like, okay.
I guess
when
you're dealing with Scream 3 and trying to put together special features, there's only so many people that'll come back and talk to you about it.
As well as an audio commentary with the screenwriter Charles Pogue.
All right. Well, that is Psycho 2. And my one complaint, I will say before we move on, is
you just third person yourself?
Yeah. Okay. My one complaint before we move on is that I understand it more with Psycho 3, but I kind of wish they'd done a fancy cover for Psycho 2.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Shout Factory, their Scream Factory offshoot, that's one of the things they're known for, is these beautiful, like, Prince of Darkness has a gorgeous painted cover.
Yeah.
Most of the movies they put out do. Not all of them, but most of them. And I can understand them not doing it with Psycho 3, but I at least kind of wanted something for Psycho 2.
Well, at least it has the original theatrical poster on both of these, which
sure,
I appreciate.
Sure.
And certainly Prince of Darkness as well. If you'd rather have the original theatrical poster, you can turn the cover inside out and have the original theatrical
cover.
Sure,
if you hate beautiful things, you just flip it over.
Hey, the original poster is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, actually. Well, moving on, we're going to talk about Hannibal Season 1.
Oh, man, this is my pick of the week. Even with all this great stuff we reviewed, I got to tell you, Hannibal is one of the best things to happen to TV in some time. And the reasoning for that for me is that somebody finally made a serious horror television series that is actually scary, artful as hell, beautiful cinematography, mm-hmm. and has you on the edge of your seat all the way through.
I agree.
This is fantastic stuff, and it really, if you know anything about TV, if you follow modern TV, it should come as no surprise to you, because this is the showrunner of this is Brian Fuller, who, even though he's been cursed with shows that the networks just haven't really supported, like Wonderfalls, Dead Like Me, Pushing Daisies, he's never done a show that wasn't fucking amazing.
He's sort of got that Joss Whedon problem where he keeps putting out really quality stuff that just doesn't last.
He has that knack for making great shows that they don't know who to sell it to because they're, I guess, I don't know if they're too smart for the audiences they're used to selling to.
I think it's more effective, the studios or the companies, you know, the production companies, the channels. I don't know the networks, thank you. The networks are too routine-minded. They're looking for formulas.
They want the next NCIS.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They don't think outside the box.
And this one follows... It actually is a prequel to Red Dragon, which is a prequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
Following Hannibal Lecter before anybody knew he was a killer. Well, except for the people he killed, who probably got kind of a clue right before
their
heart stopped beating.
A little too late.
But Hugh Dancy here plays Special Agent Will Graham, who is the main character in Red Dragon, which is basically... Wait, Red Dragon is Will Graham hunting Hannibal Lecter after we already know Hannibal is a killer, that he's had some trouble for a while before the movie even started catching, and it's sort of the final cat and mouse game between these two brilliant minds. Here, he has no idea. He's a young, gifted criminal profiler, a professor who teaches profiling, who gets called back into the game despite being mentally on the edge himself.
Yeah.
By Lawrence Fishburne, who plays Jack Crawford.
I really like that piece of casting.
Yeah.
I like Fishburne as Crawford.
Who played him in Silence of the Lambs?
Scott Glenn?
Yeah, Scott Glenn. Scott Glenn played him in Silence of the Lambs, who works at the FBI, head of the Behavioral Sciences Department, and Graham's direct boss. He basically, even though he knows that Graham is on the edge, that he's told repeatedly by a psychiatry professor, Dr. Alana Bloom, that you cannot put Will into these situations dealing with serial killers. He is about to have a major breakdown. He's like, look, nobody, and I mean nobody, is better at this than he is. I mean, Will is practically a psychic at the way he's able to put stuff together.
Yeah.
He literally starts hallucinating when he gets into crime scenes and is able to put together what happened.
Well, there's a sort of visual trademark to the show that every time Will kind of gets to a crime scene, he starts to put himself in the eyes of the killer in reverse time, and there's this weird sort of like pendulum that swings back and forth in front of the camera with this very distinct sound effect, and then you start to see what Will sees, and it's a really cool effect.
It's done extremely well. For something that in storytelling is cliched, this finds an entirely new way to do it.
And I think the reason it feels new is because of how fascinating it is that Will and the people he's tracking are so close in terms of their mental state.
Yes.
They're so on the same level that you almost fear Will Graham.
Well, and that's one of the running things in this first season, is that Will is doubting his own sanity to the point where one of the running themes of the show is he starts to wonder if he himself hasn't become a serial killer without him even being aware of it. And so are the audience, in fact.
Yeah.
Despite knowing what happens in Red Dragon, we still doubt. We still don't know. It's possible that he is, in fact, a killer himself.
Well, they've already taken some really cool liberties with the story. I mean, I like the idea that they've changed Freddie Lowndes into a female, who is sort of the tabloid crime reporter who's always a thorn in Will's side because all she really wants is the story, and she's willing to say things that are downright inaccurate just to kind of stir the pot. And, you know. But I like the fact that, you know, in Red Dragon the movie, I will say I've never read the book, but at least in Red Dragon the movie, which I assumed is pretty faithful to the book, maybe I'm making a too great an assumption there, but he's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, that's right. Jeez, I forgot.
And they've changed that character to a young female reporter, and she's just so... She's not quite on the same level as the character from Luther, whose name I'm forgetting, the, like, female serial killer.
Oh, Alice?
Yeah. Not quite on that level, but still, like, their adversarial relationship just really is one of the hearts of the show, I think.
Now, of course, we know, watching the show, that the killer of all killers is Hannibal Lecter. And here, nobody knows he's anything but one of the great forensic psychologists, Dr. Hannibal Lecter, played here in a absolutely inspired casting choice by Mads Mikkelsen, who has chosen to go a completely different direction with playing this role than Brian Cox or Anthony Hopkins did before.
Yeah.
And it's a well-chosen choice, quite frankly.
I think that was one of the concerns I had when this show was first announced, that it would, before even Mikkelsen was...
That it would devolve into camp.
Yeah, well, that it would just be an imitation.
Yeah.
That it would be whoever they cast as Hannibal Lecter would just be doing an Anthony Hopkins impersonation. And Mads is doing the exact opposite of that. He has found a very sort of bizarre and weirdly comforting quiet to the role. Like, he's so collected at all points and so elegant that it's just I can't help but, like, really love the guy, even though I know that he's committing these really horrible, you know,
because he has that atrocities. Same quality that Anthony Hopkins does in one sense, that he's such a genius, he's so brilliant, he's so 100 steps ahead of the game, that you can't help but admire him on some level.
Yeah.
And he also has that personality that's like a psychologist. He's got a father figure attitude that everyone comes to him, especially Lawrence Fishburne's Jack Crawford, who trusts mm-hmm. him implicitly to the point where when he knows that Will Graham is in psychological trouble and needs someone there for him, otherwise, if he's going to start helping, otherwise his sanity's in danger, he starts sending Will to Hannibal Lecter to be his psychologist, which, of course, is playing with fire. Because Hannibal is, if you've seen Red Dragon or read the books, you know, one of the only people he admires is Will Graham. But you don't want the admiration of Hannibal Lecter.
Not really.
It's the only thing slightly less worse than not having the admiration of Hannibal Lecter. And only slightly less worse. Because Hannibal... like, to him, Will is, he admires him for his intelligence and his skills, but to him, he's a plaything. He's somebody he wants to experiment with and explore, and this season really explores that.
Yeah.
And wow, what visual creativity goes on in this. I mean, and just imagination, the way they put together what's going on in Will's mind is bit by bit, he's starting to come to the realization of what Hannibal actually is told entirely metaphorically through symbols, just inch by inch, putting it together in his brain as we see these horrifying nightmare images that Will sees that keep reoccurring to him that reflect these crimes, which are some of the most inventive serial crimes I've ever seen in anything.
Oh, definitely. And the show, I think one of the things that keeps people watching is they found such a spectacular beauty in the grotesque. I mean, even the scenes where, you know, somebody's organs are being harvested and cooked still have there's almost something symphonic about the way it's shot. You know, it's just... so gorgeous.
Well, as well as the way that we regularly see Hannibal cooking dinner for everyone. Like, he cooks dinner for Lawrence Fishburne all the time, where we know he's serving them human meat. Mm-hmm. We know it is. But the food is, as we see in one of the bonus features on the disc, Brian Fuller said, I want the food scenes to be food porn. I want it to be like those cooking shows.
Definitely.
And that's exactly what it is. He's a master chef, and he's making these meals that look incredible and delicious. And then you remember, oh shit, that's human meat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you want to be at arm's length with it, but it does look so delicious.
Also good in here, just for mention before we move on to the extra features, Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall has a pretty funny role as a crime scene investigator who's... it's an odd choice for casting, but it works. He's that tiny bit of levity that the show needs. And Gillian Anderson from The X-Files is Hannibal Lecter's psychotherapist, who for a while I thought was a hallucination Hannibal was having.
Yeah.
But finally we get to see her interact with a regular person. You're like, okay, I guess she's a real person, but really like has a really interesting role that I can hardly wait to see where it's going to go as the series continues.
And I like that they've already set up, like, you see the hospital. Like that, I think it's like episode 5 or 6. That episode where they actually go into the Baltimore, like, state hospital prison, where, you know, in Silence of the Lambs, that's where Hannibal Lecter ends up. And just walking those halls again and meeting Dr. Childress again. And yeah. I was just like, oh man, I love the way they're playing with the lore. I love the way they're playing with established canon here.
Yeah, they've chosen to say this is a different world than the world we've seen in the films already in the books, but those events will happen, just not necessarily in the way we saw them happen before. In fact, Fuller has announced before that he fully expects the Red Dragon story to start, if they're allowed to get there, around season 3 or 4 and go on for 2 or 3 seasons. You know, so yes, he does intend for this to overlap Red Dragon and take what would have to be a very different tact from the way that show went.
Right.
But enough so that when familiar things happen, you're like, oh shit, they're doing that part of the story.
I can't wait. Such a great show.
Lots of great bonus features on here, the best of which is A Taste for Killing on Disc 2, which is about 15-minute funny piece where they got a master chef to design all the food for this, like a professional gourmet master chef who's talking with Brian Fuller about like the art of creating these meals that are essentially from human meat. And it gets so like where it plays on that food porn of yourself. You're like, oh man, that looks tasty, as they're talking about real food. And it's like, but then I had to figure out how to do it with human intestines. And like, Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm hungry or terrified.
It's really clever. It's really funny. And it's actually a great picture of almost like a sort of a metaphor for everything that they've done on the show in a lot of ways. There's a really funny gag reel that comes right after that appropriately, appropriately titled a gag reel, I suppose. And a lot of other bonus features on here. This is a great collection they put together of one of the best TV series to come along in a while.
It's one of my favorite new shows on TV.
Yeah.
I dig the hell out of this. And it's one of those things that, again, when you initially heard, oh, they're doing a show about Hannibal Lecter, a lot of us were like, really? Really? And yeah. I feel like Brian Fuller has just done a tremendous job to excel beyond the concept, beyond the conceit, and create something that is just truly, truly beautiful.
I never thought anybody could take Hannibal Lecter and put him in, and replace him in my mind from Anthony Hopkins. But Mads Mikkelsen has done it.
Yeah, and that is stellar praise.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things that Chris thinks is stellar, why don't we talk about this block of Doctor Who shit on the list? There's a lot of Doctor Who on this week's list.
Goodbye, horror! Goodbye! Goodbye!
Adios!
Well, let's start off with, of course, the big thing, which is Doctor Who, the complete seventh series. Now, BBC lately has taken to splitting up these seasons just because they are, in fact, split up with time when they put them out. This is getting more and more irritating.
But what about space?
With people having these huge divisions between, like, in the middle of their season, just call them different fucking seasons! Drives me up the wall! But nonetheless, this puts together the two seasons already previously released into one collection. Now, season 7 is a mixed bag, to be sure. We get about 5 episodes of the previous companions, Amy and Rory, and a very sad final farewell for those characters. Not to spoil anything, it's sad, but not necessarily in the way you're thinking. And the introduction of a brand new extra person. Whatever her name is. Why am I can't remember her name? Because I'm stupid.
Don't look at me.
Stupid. Clara Oswald, that's her name, who seemed to be hated by a lot of the fans, but I didn't really have a problem with her. I just didn't like the way they wrapped up the end of this. I really didn't like the end of this season. I thought it was, I don't know, chintzy in the way they wrapped up the story. Not very satisfying. And it also ends with a weird sort of, I'm not even sure if that was a cliffhanger type of ending. What the fuck was that?
I can't even see the cliff.
You know, there's a weird sort of like, wait, what does that even mean? What does that have to do with anything? I guess we'll know in November when they do the special Doctor crossover episode with Matt Smith and David Tennant, which I'm really looking forward to.
Nerd.
Really looking forward to. Holy shit. But the seventh season, we get actually you get bonus features that you did not get, of course, in the two separate ones. That being said, if you want them all, you got to get those two separate ones too, because there's 3 44-minute television specials that come on those separate ones that aren't on this. The Best of the Doctor, The Best of the Companions, and The Best of the Monsters. This comes with commentary on the episode The Snowmen. It comes a 43-minute special look on Doctor Who in the U.S. and why it's popular here. 12 minutes on the last days of the Ponds. Also has a look at the Battle of Demons Run, the big battle here in this series 2 days later. Brand new to this, there's the Nerdist television show on BBC where Doctor Who is there with 3 interviews, 2 with Matt Smith and 1 with Jenna Louise Coleman. Talking to him, there is Creating Clara, a look with Stephen Moffat, Matt Smith, and Jenna Louise Coleman taking a look at Claire and how they built her. Commentaries for a bunch of episodes. Lots of 55 minutes of behind the scenes featurettes. 45 minutes of looks at the companions. This is all, like I said, new stuff to the set. Not with the previous ones. And several prequel minisodes that we had not seen before. 4 new prequel minisodes that had aired online that have not been released on the previous sets as well. We get, except for those 3 features I mentioned before, all the extra bonus features we saw on the other sets. So this is actually a collection that, even if you bought those others, is well worth your cash picking up. Assuming you're a fan of Matt Smith and Matt Smith's Doctor Who, I'm starting to actually look forward to the new Doctor coming in because I'm kind of like, okay, I think that Matt Smith's kind of run his course with the story. I'd like to see something new. I like the idea of an older Doctor, but we'll see. Now, if you want talking about older Doctors, they've released Doctor Who The Ice Warriors on DVD.
Which I assume is very much like The Ice Pirates.
No, not at all.
Oh, disappointing.
This is from the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton, who is often called The Tramp of the doctors, you know, the Charlie Chaplin type of tramp. And the idea here is that in the distant future on America, the glaciers are taking over, the second ice age is full in effect, and they've got a time span to get the fuck off this planet or deal with it. And these guys are at this station, they're trying to figure out what to do. And Doctor Who shows up with his two companions. The problem is, right as this happens, these guys uncover a figure frozen in ice. It ends up being an ice warrior, an ancient warlike race that was frozen in ice and apparently doesn't have a problem with ice crystals forming in the blood and then splitting their body apart like would happen with human beings if we were frozen in ice. So that's why...
I've gone cross-eyed.
That's why that type of freezing and like living forever is impossible, and why Walt Disney's head frozen in ice wouldn't do any good. So Walt Disney's dead forever.
Are you telling me that Ted Williams is actually dead?
I'm telling you that, yes.
Oh, sad.
But the ice warriors get all activated. They start unfreezing other ice warriors. Meanwhile, the glaciers are moving in. The doctor has to deal with lots of stuff. Okay, it's an old Doctor Who episode. It's been fixed up very nice. Two episodes in the middle of it are lost. No one knows what would happen to it. So they've gotten this animation company now that it's the reason we've been getting re-releases of some of this early stuff, who have been doing pretty cool animations of the episodes because they still have the audio tracks. So they just make new animations that look kind of like Archer. They have that same kind of style as Archer. I kept going when we were watching it. Danger Zone! Couldn't help it. It works pretty well. So you get the full six episodes with two in the middle being animated, as well as a ton of bonus features, because these new DVDs, the BBC is not fucking around with like making these worth your buck. There's all kinds of extra features they throw on here, including a making of featurette that's actually pretty long called Cold Fusion. Get it?
I get it.
Get it?
I do.
A look at the actor who played Jamie, one of the companions. There's a featurette on the cartoon, the creation of the animated episodes. There's a recon of the missing episodes, the abbreviated Telesnap version that appeared on the VHS release of this adventure. And some clips from a TV show called Blue Peter that was popular at the time. Don't start, Brian.
I didn't say a word.
That they had a contest.
I mean, it's cold there, but I didn't.
They had a contest for fans to create their own Doctor Who monsters. And they actually created the monsters, you know, such as they do with the BBC workshop. It's actually kind of cool. You're like, oh, that's kind of funny. They built these really ridiculous, like a four-year-old's idea of what a Doctor Who monster would be, and they nice. Actually built it. And I was like, okay, that's pretty fun. So lots of good stuff on here. If you're a big fan of Doctor Who, it's not one of the stronger episodes, quite frankly. I've always heard the book was better. They novelized all these.
Oh, it was like the book was better. No,
they novelized all these. And I remember hearing that the book was actually a lot more entertaining because there's a lot of boring, like, what do we do? What does this dial do? The thermonuclear Shingavada is set to 18 parsons and we need to get it to 15 parsons or the tuber nucleosis tachyon receptacle will overload, that kind of talk. You're like, okay, I don't know what you're saying and I don't give a fuck.
I think I read that in the MacGuffin manual.
Let's move on to Doctor Who's monsters killing people because that's more entertaining. Better than that is the release of Scream of the Shalka from the same animated, I believe it's the same animated group who did that, the animated pieces in here. But what this was a... All right, so after Doctor Who ended, because there was a period where it was just over, there was no new Doctor Who at all. They were like, look, it doesn't look like there's going to be a new live Doctor Who. No one at the BBC seems really interested. Let's try and put together a low-budget animated film that gets Richard David, Richard E. Grant to play the next Doctor, the Doctor who comes after, Paul, what's his face from the American? Like, boy, I have a couple beers and I can't remember anyone's name.
You're looking at me for help, like I know anything about Doctor Who. I'm sitting over here like Doctor Who.
It's funny because in the latest season, Richard E. Grant actually plays one of the main villains, but here he played a doctor that they fully intended to go on and have a series of animated adventures, and he's actually great. This animated adventure, it's really well written. It's a lot of fun. Richard E. Grant has got a whole new take on the Doctor. It makes me sad that this did not stay canon, because apparently, I guess after they saw it, they're like, you know what, maybe we should just do another live series, which they went on to do and said, yeah, you know that series with Richard, that one with Richard E. Grant? Didn't actually happen. So, sorry about that. Despite the fact at the time when it came out, it was considered to be canon, it didn't. And even funnier, Derek Jacobi, who in it was playing the Master, or at least a robot Master that the Doctor had created for his own. It's not entirely clear. Like, he had uploaded the Master's consciousness into a robot that he had to obey the Doctor's will to travel around the cosmos with. Master being one of the primary Doctor villains. He ended up playing the Master later on in the live action show. So that was actually kind of fun. This is actually very much worth your time. Like I said, it's a cool story. It's actually even a little scary at points. It's pretty inventive. And it, of course, like all Doctor Who releases, comes with a buttload of bonus features, analyzing about every aspect of this that you could want to see. Well worth your time if you're a Doctor Who fan for picking up. Ice Warriors, maybe not so much. Unless you're a completist. Scream of the Shalka, really good.
Awesome. Well, that was sort of our Who Corner. And now we're going to move on to South Park Season 16. It has been 16-plus years, because they've had years where they didn't have seasons come out. It's been a long... I remember the first episode aired when I was in, like, 7th grade.
Was it...
Maybe not the first episode. Shit, maybe it was even before that.
I remember going to Spike and Mike's Twisted Festival of Animation and seeing the very first South Park.
Oh, the Christmas card thing. They made, the animated Christmas card.
Yeah, seeing that and going, oh, it's so funny. And then seeing the second thing they did for those and going, oh, it's funny. And then hearing they were making a series and go, really? They're making a series of that? That's going to be awful.
Wrong.
Because South Park has ended up being, I mean, it's been consistently great for longer than The Simpsons was, quite frankly.
Well, not only that, but it is legitimately the most biting social satire on television.
Oh,
like, the way they send up current events is mind-blowing. And sometimes they make you earn it. Sometimes you have to sit there for a while this sort of strange story is going on with these four kids, and then a line of dialogue or some twist in the narrative will come and you go, oh, they're talking about, and boom, it hits you.
Well, yeah, because you still get that degree of gross out, just ridiculous gross humor that if that was all there was,
nobody
it
would
wouldn't
like this
be
show.
Very special.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they're always talking about something else, really, and it's so genius the way they actually do it. Now, sometimes it's less dense with social commentary than others.
Yeah, some episodes are just like, I think my favorite example of the other type of episode is the Queef episode.
Yeah, very true.
She's like, that's all it's about. You're welcome.
Sometimes it is about just pushing it to the very edge of like what's acceptable. But this season, I don't think it's quite as good as the last season, which I absolutely love. I believe it was the last season that had the giant Cthulhu versus Cartman.
Yeah, the like super best friend guys.
That was
absolutely
amazing.
Yeah.
So great. One of the best things they've ever done. But there's a lot of great stuff in this season.
My favorite episode of this entire season is the bullying episode.
Uh-huh.
Because there is a line of dialogue in that episode that is such a middle finger to the Weinsteins. It is incredible. The whole episode is basically this guy comes in with this anti-bullying company, wants to make this anti-bullying movie, but he is himself such a bully about it, and then everybody starts bullying everybody else all under the guise of, we're trying to make a difference and stop bullying, so quit being a dork and help us. What, are you going to cry now? Like, it's, and then Kyle has the best line, which is, all right, Stan, if this is so important and everyone needs to see it, why don't you put it on the internet for free? And there's just a silence, and you realize that that's Matt and Trey going, fuck you, Weinstein.
That's hysterical.
Your bully documentary came out. You were the biggest bullies in Hollywood. Go fuck yourself.
That's really funny.
And I was just like, whoa, that's incredible.
Well, my two favorite episodes this season, one was, that was Butterballs, for the record.
Yes.
My two favorites are, one was I Never Should Have Gone Ziplining. Which was done as like one of those survival TV shows where the boys like go
those vacation from hell shows on history or
the
whatever.
The boys all go to the Colorado mountains learning how to do zip line. It turns out to be like the lamest fucking shit ever. Like,
yeah.
It's so awful. They would rather get eaten by mountain lions than keep doing
it.
And it ends, the last like 10 minutes of this is all live action where they get actors who are playing them.
Yeah. It's like, the whole thing is modeled after one of those, like we were saying, like survival shows on, I don't know, Discovery or whatever. But of course, what they're surviving is intense boredom.
Yeah.
So he gets to the end and they do like the reenactment you always see on those shows with real people. And it's just funny to see the actors that they got to portray, you know, Stan and Kyle and Cartman and Kenny. So.
Yeah. No, it actually is pretty damn funny. My favorite though, and this had me holding my stomach laughing. At one point I had to pause it because I was laughing so hard. And this has a lot to do with who I am. was Faith Hilling.
Oh, God.
Which is the episode about, like, people who'd, like, do memes, like, planking, who take pictures of themselves doing weird shit in public places. And here they invent one called Faith Hilling, where you pull your shirt up in front of you like you got boobs. I don't know why I'm doing it now. Like,
you like anyone can see you. Yeah, exactly. It's just for my benefit.
But the boys are doing that, and they're obsessed that this is the only good meme. But the problem is with memes, they just keep moving on fast. A meme becomes dead the moment you hear about it, pretty much. And the new meme that's dangerous starts, as they say, a new meme has been started that's putting humans in danger that was invented not by a human, but by cats, called O-Long Johnson, which is integrates one of my favorite ever cat videos on the internet of this cat that, for whatever reason, when it's like meowing, it sounds like it's saying human words.
It's eerie.
I mean, it's not making sense. It says like, O-Long Johnson. Oh, Don Piano!
Yeah, it's the weirdest shit.
It's really creepy video to watch, but it's so funny. And they have this cat with, like, saying, oh, this cat started this as a meme where people have to, like, stand on the train tracks or something and say Oh Long Johnson as many times as they can before the train comes. So it's, like, actually hurting people by doing this. And they put this, using the video of the cat integrated, they put the cat on trial.
Yeah.
It's, like, in a box, like, what do you think, cat? Oh Long Johnson!
How dare you defy us?
It's really fucking funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really like it. There's a lot of good stuff on this season. Like I said, not quite as good as the last season, I would say, because that had that great arc in there towards the end, but still well worth your time, as you would expect from South Park. After all these years, they still fucking deliver.
Still one of my favorite entertainment documentaries is, I think it's eight days to air, 6 days to air, something like that. It's just a behind the scenes documentary about how they make South Park and the week that it takes them to produce an entire episode. So enthralling. And just the way that they work is maddening.
Is that on one of the previous seasons?
I think it's on like 12 or 13. I can't remember. It was a Comedy Central like special that they did. And it was just them and like how they work, like them in the writer's room with Bill Hader, who I didn't realize was one of their writers.
Yeah.
Sitting there in the writing room and trying to, they ended up, it was human centipede episode is what it eventually became.
Yeah, so that was like either last season or the season before.
Yeah, and it's just so gripping to watch because they really do everything down to the wire. And just their process and like how they,
so topical. It's ridiculous.
It's, and just, I was dazzled by it.
I remember like some episodes like coming out that were dealing with news issues, like in their entirety dealing with news issues that had just happened that week.
I remember distinctly in college when they caught Saddam Hussein, they caught him on a Sunday. On Wednesday, that's what the episode was about.
Yeah.
It blew my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible what they put together. I want to just say one last thing about this season before we finish up on South Park.
Long Johnson.
Profound. Profound.
Don Piano.
It's so funny. When you started talking about that episode being a film, like, why is that episode his favorite? And then about 3 seconds into me saying that, I was like, because of the fucking cat videos. It's got to be the cat videos.
It's pretty fucking funny.
No, it's hilarious. But I was like, it's the damn cat video.
It is. He embarrassedly admitted.
Well, from there, why don't we talk about Grimm season 2?
You know what? Grimm is one of those shows that should be better than it is, but it has enough that is good that you stick with it anyway. It's those frustrating shows that can't get past the network definition of what a show should be that like this, that's been going on since like the days of the X-Files, that just can't seem to break free of those trappings, those strictures of just like, this is what we expect from this kind of storytelling.
Right.
And it's a shame because there's a lot of good stuff going on the show. This came out at the same time as the show started, at the same time as Once Upon a Time, which ended up being Once Upon a Time ended up being by far the superior of the two shows.
Well, it's got its own spinoff now.
Yeah, it's actually a really good show. Grimm is still on that part where it's like they're still figuring it out. They're still trying to figure out what their strengths are and what they aren't. And yet, it's entertaining enough if you like Monster of the Week supernatural type shows and you like some of the strong characters that are in this that you might very well want to sit down and give it a try. David Giantoli plays Nick Burkhart, who is the titular Grimm. Now, what Grimms are, like Grimm's fairy tales and what have you, are this race of people. They're human, but they're genetically gifted with the ability to be stronger, more powerful, and more capable of seeing all these creatures called the Vessen who exist throughout our world. Like, you know, they look like humans, but inside they actually are like wolf people or snake people, or they're all, you know, based on some kind of animal, basically. And many times they're related in some degree to a Grimm's fairy tale type character, although not as much as you'd expect, strangely.
Considering the show is called Grimm.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time they're just people animals, pretty much. They're were owls and were snakes.
They're animagus, I believe is what that's called, right?
Well, no, animagus are humans who have magic and can turn themselves into an animal. These guys are kind of both at the same time. Like, people can't see that they're an animal thing, but their true form is an animal, and they only if they want people to see them as this animal will they see it.
This is the nerdiest conversation the Grimm we've ever had.
Can see them whenever, at least whenever the plot says it's convenient for him to be able to see them. Here in the second season, we've seen him already go through a lot because these goddamn long 23, 24 episode shows. Fuck, I wish people would stop putting these fucking things out.
Oh, the seasons are 24 episodes?
Yeah, like old Scott, once again, you're like, oh, for Christ's sakes, will we please all switch to the 12 or 13 episode season, please? Yeah.
8 is too few, 24 is far too many.
Yeah, yeah, 12 or 13 is the magic number right now, and I wish everybody would switch to that. But the running story here is we saw at the end of the first season, the main guy's, his fiance, is in a coma because of a girl who's what they call a hexen beast. She's not really a beast creature. She's more of like a witch. So she looks like a horrible, haggard old witch when we don't see her. And the rest of the time, she looks like a total fucking hottie. You know, that would be confusing in bed.
Yes, it would.
Let's hope that the real face doesn't come on when she has an orgasm. Not that you'd have to worry about that, Brian. But
wait, what? Still,
wait, no, I'm sorry. Let me just continue.
What?
But basically, our Grimm took away the side of her that is a hexen beast, so she has no powers anymore. But still knowing how to do some witchy stuff with cooking, essentially, she casts a spell on his girlfriend to put her in this coma. We find out that spell had a lot more to it than we thought this season, as she's awoken from this coma from the Grimm, Nick's captain, who Nick just thinks is his captain, played by Sasha Ruiz, Captain Sean Renard, but is actually a prince of the royal court of basically the people who know about what all the shit is going on. You know, he's a dick.
Yeah.
Or at least his family is. We're not really sure what he is. Is he a dick? Is he against his family? Is he for it? One of the more interesting things of the season is, whose side is this guy really on? Because he's a bastard of the royal court, and they don't even really like him that much. But he's still royal, and he, in order to awaken Nick's fiancée, has to give her a kiss, because he is a prince. The problem is it creates an obsessive relationship between the two of them, where all they can think about is each other all the time. That gets worse and worse, even though neither one of them wants to do anything to hurt Nick. And even worse, she has selective amnesia, where she can remember everything that's ever happened to her, except anything that has to do with Nick.
Convenient.
Yes. A little too convenient. An old television trope. Selective amnesia, so you don't have to deal with the fact that in the end of the last season, the character just revealed to him all his secrets.
Yeah. And they get struck by lightning. I don't remember anything.
Making up for that is Russell Hornsby, who's Nick's cop partner, Hank, who's been completely oblivious to the whole first season, but shortly on into the second season, they just, look, this is stupid. Here's what the deal is. And he's like, that actually explains a lot.
Oh, I get it now.
It's actually a huge help to the season, the fact that he knows now what's going on. Better than the first season, not quite there yet. Its still greatest strength is the actor Silas Weir Mitchell, who plays Monroe, who's what they call a Blutbad, who is basically the Big Bad Wolf, like a race of the Big Bad Wolf, except, you know, I mean, he can turn into the Big Bad Wolf. He can turn into a wolf creature, be all strong and shit. But he just wants – he's a nerd. He just wants to live a normal life. He didn't want to kill anybody. He's just like, look, I'm sorry. That's my race. Don't be racist against me, motherfucker. I didn't blow over anything.
Big, quote-unquote, bad wolf.
He's actually a great character and so incredibly likable in this that I wish the show was just about him. They don't do anywhere near enough about him. They do way too much with the girlfriend, with her blundering around. Why don't I remember Nick? What's going on? Oh, who gives a fuck? You're boring. You don't do anything special. I'm sorry. You're like, let's focus half our season on the character who doesn't have any mythological background, doesn't do anything special except look confused. Bad call.
Sounds like it.
But there's still some good stuff here so far. I only got about halfway through this before we had to record this episode, but enough so that I was like, okay, I'm looking forward to the next episode. Still, God, just, it's so close to being a good show. And they probably should work on the CG because all the monster, a lot of CG. Cause every time, all right, here's the deal. Like when people do the monster face, they look human and they do the thing where they like, it looks like they just sneezed where they're like, shake their head. And when they do it, the monster face comes on like, and then they do it again, back to human again. And it always looks like it's on a Commodore 64.
No, I remember that from watching the first season that would just look so shitty. So what you're saying is that's not something that's been corrected.
It looks even worse, if anything.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it's awful. I wish they could get this right, because sometimes the show is super entertaining, but damn, what the fuck? They just, it's like the network just does not give a fuck.
Mm.
So I can only recommend this to those who like this sort of episodic show and don't give a fuck about the details, who are like, hey, I know there's a lot better stuff out there. I just think the lead guy is cute or something. I don't know.
But changing the channel is hard.
Changing the channel is difficult. I'm going to keep watching this. There's actually an interesting thing with Mary Elizabeth Mastriano, who appears as Nick's mom. Who's pretty cool and not in here anywhere long enough, quite frankly. But it is a lot less episodic, a lot more mythology oriented than the last ones. And honestly, the point at about the halfway point where it's really built up the stress of this weird triangle between Nick, his boss, and his fiance has actually gotten pretty fucking interesting. So I don't know. Mixed review.
Yeah, clear. I don't know. Stuff and things.
Whatever.
Well, that brings us to our last title of the show, which is The We and the I.
Now that you've got to say like Christopher Walken.
Is the we and also the I.
See, that sounds like.
And it's one of us. We're doing the review.
I'm sorry. I got to pick someone else for you to do impressions of. Who else are you good at doing impressions of?
Patrick Warburton.
All right. Do it like Patrick Warburton.
Well, the last title we're going to talk about is called The We and the I. Not really sure what it's about, but I kind of dig the title.
You got to work on your Shatner. All right.
Yeah, I'll get on that. That'll be the next one.
This is actually not the newest, because we just saw the newest Michel Gondry film at Fantastic Fest, but the second newest film by Michel Gondry, who's best known, of course, from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, one of my favorite movies ever made. Gondry is a master of the twee visual, very flights of fancy that are pleasing to the eye and the imagination, certainly. Mm-hmm. Immense amounts of creativity that follows a sort of dream logic in a lot of his films. This is the exception.
What?
This is not a dream logic film at all. In fact, every once in a while, there'll be a sequel where Gondry's like, I'm going to kind of do my thing for 20 seconds here. Do y'all mind? Do you mind?
Weird.
But it is nothing. It's just kind of like people remembering something, and it's presented in sort of a be kind, rewind sort of
like
way.
A sweeted version of
the memory sort of thing. But it's a very small part of the film. Ultimately, what you have here is a story. Like I said, the last thing you'd expect from Gondry, which is a bunch of high school kids on the last day of school who are riding the public bus transit through the city home to their various houses. And throughout this film, they one by one get off the bus. And we start to see all these little stories in these high school dramas that have developed between all these people as they play out and develop and change. And these relationships, these characters are affected as this goes on. And this was used with a bunch of like, young amateur actors they workshopped this for 3 years ahead of time to try and make this thing happen. And it's a very odd film in that I came out of it not sure I don't think it worked, but you can't help but admire what they were trying to do.
Can't help but admire the experiment, if nothing else.
It's an interesting experiment, and it does get you wrapped up in it as you see all these stories play out. Because at first you're like, these kids are just irritating and I want them all to die. Because they're all just a bunch of bullies.
Yeah.
But as it goes on, we see a lot more depth with them. We see a lot more sides to them. And finally, when we get to the end and it's just one or two kids, we think of all these kids completely differently from how we did at the beginning. Gondry's created a fascinating idea for a film. He just didn't really quite finish it, because a lot of the stories in here that seem very pertinent to finish out, like a story of a girl in here who was gotten intentionally made so drunk at a party that another character, basically a female character, basically raped her during this party.
What?
Never is resolved in any way, shape, or form. And you're like, wouldn't that be one of the bigger stories among all these stories?
You think that would come up again.
They just kind of abandon it, quite frankly. But there is enough, more than enough interesting stuff here to keep your attention going throughout. It's a Gondry experiment, just not the type of Gondry experiment we're used to seeing in films like Silence, the Science of Sleep and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Human Nature. It's something new for him and therefore worth at least paying attention to.
Right on. Well, that's the end of the show, so I guess the only thing we have left to do is talk about the
giveaways!
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we have two giveaways this week.
That we do, Brian. Let me tell you what they are.
Please do.
This week we have two fantastic giveaways for you, coming from Scream Factory, the subset of Shout Factory, two of our favorite releases this week. First up, we have coming for you that sequel to the original Alfred Hitchcock Psycho that we discussed earlier this week, Psycho 2 on Blu-ray.
Hell yes, Psycho 2 on Blu-ray. And as you all know, we've moved away from a sort of fastest finger who can see what quickest type of giveaway, and we're doing something more creative now. So we're going to give you a prompt here and now, a creative prompt, and you will leave your response in the comment section. We'll pick our favorite. And for Psycho 2, here's my challenge to you. What is the most inappropriate Hitchcock sequel you could conceive of? What is the movie that you're sequelizing, and what would the plot be?
I like it.
And I want it to be as divergent from the original film as possible.
And cast it.
Oh, sure, cast it.
Definitely cast it.
Why not? But that's not all. We also have for you John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness.
On Blu-ray.
On Blu-ray.
This would have been my, if Hannibal hadn't come out this week, this would have been my pick of the week.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. So for Prince of Darkness, here is my challenge to you. I want you to describe your containment system for the ultimate evil. What is it that you store it in? And not only that, but what is your manifestation of the ultimate evil? So maybe there's a relationship between what it is and what you keep it in. As like in the movie Prince of Darkness, they keep the devil in weird ectoplasm in a rotating, looks like a cryptic, you know, some kind of weird column. But I want to know what the ultimate evil is for you and what you would keep it in. So go ahead and put those responses in the comment section. We will pick our favorite, and there will be a winner for Psycho 2, and there will be a winner for Prince of Darkness.
Aren't you lucky?
You are lucky. I mean, I'm not saying we're trying to bribe you to vote for us in the podcast awards.
But we are totally.
But we've been giving away something every single week since this show started, and that means since the show started on that other site. So, I mean, we've run through a lot of free shit.
We've gotten pretty good at giving away stuff, I gotta say right now. As your guys to go to for awesome Blu-rays and DVDs for free, we're kind of the kings.
We kind of are. Toot our own horn a little bit. Well, guys, yeah, that's gonna do it for us here on Digital Noise this week. And I remind you, you can go onto Amazon.com via any of our links, buy anything you want, and that supports the site. We very much appreciate it. You can also like Digital Noise on Facebook, which is facebook.com/digitalnoise.oneofus.
I believe so. Yeah. Okay. Something like that.
Or if you just want to like the site proper, you can just go to facebook.com/oneofusnet and like us there. You can also follow the show at DigiNoiseCast. That's D-I-G-I NoiseCast. You can follow us individually on Twitter. I'm at BryGuySalisbury.
I'm at Chris Cox Critic.
So if you can wrap your lips around that mouthful, and go ahead and follow
and
Chris.
Ladies, you know what to do.
Oh, boy. Well, yep, that's going to do it for us this week. Sorry the show's a little late. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And until next week, I just want to remind you that Alice Cooper is not to be trusted.